I'm able to report that Edison Carter was pulled off the air. The incident has not gone public.
Are we certain the incident was connected with the blip advertisements?
Not yet.
It won't be so simple if news of this leaks out.
My God. Come on, Ben. The only people that inactive are pensioners, the sick, or the unemployed. I mean, who really cares?
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. World War III, week 17. Welcome to the Bristol Politics Show on the 26th of June, 2026. We had the wonderful solstice this week with everyone dancing at Stonehenge, not really necessarily thinking about the practices of the Druids, which weren't altogether averse to child sacrifice. It's like the amount of time that's passed, people haven't really figured out what was going on back then. Obviously, there were a lot of really decent people around back in those days, but the Druids weren't one of them. We could almost compare it to the one lifetime that there's been really since World War II, which people have been persuaded to forget about everything that happened there. But not in Poland this week, as we'll be hearing later on. We're streaming live from the Kumba Centre, close by the Bristol City Centre. Don't believe a word we say. But we do try to share moments of clarity from Bristol's Templar Port turned merchant venturer fiefdom in the city of London's Empire of Lies. Bristol's only national news show is coming to you live on the talkradio.org.uk stream at djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, holylandradio.com in West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Bristol Politics Show app, available free from GitHub and Apple App Store. Thisweek.org.uk is the easiest place to find it, but not, and you will not find it, at the evil Google Play. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the Talk Radio stream, except at 5 on Monday to Thursday when we bring you the Richie Allen Show live. Tonight, guess what? We have a resigned Prime Minister. He's just about past his sell-by date. He's run his course. He's had it, basically. As we were saying last week, a dud. And he was a dud. So we'll be trying to hear a little bit less from Sir Keir Starmer, but we will be having listened to his last bits of his last Prime Minister's questions. It's the usual stuff. I suppose what Martin would call boilerplate. The idea is to try and sound authoritative but say nothing. We'll also be focusing on Ukraine and Russia, which is looking increasingly dangerous as the MI6 inspired NATO people try to bomb Russia increasingly. At some point, of course, Russia is going to bomb them. That means us, folks. And also a bit of Dr. Beeching, because the book which I discussed many years ago, 2012-ish, maybe a little bit after that, no, 2013, that's right, with Richard Cottrell, the journalist that had worked in mainstream press right the way through the Beeching era and was a campaigner to keep the railways open in the mid-1960s. He also blamed Barbara Castle, the Labour Transport Minister, for most of the closures. Beeching was a sort of nobody in the middle of it all who was stood up and said things but wasn't involved. Anyway, Richard was the first to reveal that, as far as I know, Beeching had been involved in the British atomic bomb project. That's called Tube Alloys. And he was based at a place called Fort Halstead near Sevenoaks, which I visited on my latest trip to London, and it's all now being turned into a housing estate. I said to the Gurkha guy who was guarding Fort Halstead last week, I said, what's happened to the underground base? And he just looked at me and said, oh, what underground base? Oh, well, this is an underground base. Everyone knew it was. And so it looks, if I'm not sure if anyone, people buying the houses, realise that they'd be living on top of the area. Maybe some of the houses are underground. Who knows? Bit of Beeching too. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its accelerationist zero trust agenda psyops. Nick Land's social Darwinists running Albert Pike's Zionist Armageddon plan. one a slave to the AI, or maybe even just dead. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie and his vampire queen Carmilla have got a bit of an outing this week with their tax bill. People are starting to realise that they're coining it on our behalf, whilst people here are going deeper and deeper into poverty. And Carmilla, as they were waging war on the British public, yes, as well as Iran, China, Russia and the BRICS. The question is their public relations mega spend trying to make themselves look great, is it going to work? The Crown prosecutes us for praying for unborn children, which is just bonkers, isn't it? And Hitler was the prototype. Now Chaos Lord Netanyahu is rolling out a red carpet for the Zionist man, God, Messiah to come. But it's not the end of the world. Or is it? Anyway, helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Reich in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. When are the Russians going to attack us, Martin?
Well, there's already an undeclared war going on, isn't there?
Well, they're so getting killed. They're being bombed.
Well, there's been plenty of US and British and other NATO military casualties in Ukraine, but it's been covered up. They've made a priority of killing those people. So there was some guy, if you remember, who was supposedly training Ukrainians, and he got killed, but it was an accident, of course. But in actual fact, I mean, I think there's quite a few people been killed.
So what do you make of the departure of Starmer eventually? I mean, because we had that, I think it was a David Dimbleby programme, I got another clip this evening from that series from December this evening, saying last week that the problem with Starmer is he's always reversing his decisions. So what we've had this week is another enormous reverse of a decision where he said, oh, I will be standing against, and he's been saying this for months, as soon as there's any sort of hint of him having to go, which has been months now, particularly after the Mandelson affair and the various revelations of him making sure that Mandelson got the job come what may, when clearly it wasn't the right decision and everyone was trying to tell him not to, but he was taking no notice of that. So it's been a long time now. People have been saying he's got to go, several major decisions, but he's decided finally to go. And also, of course, he had to say, I'm not going to be standing. So why do you think he bothered to say that I will be standing against anyone that challenges me in the first place? Why did he bother to say that when everyone knew it was a lie?
Well, at that point, it wasn't necessarily a lie. He just had a look at the lie of the land and realised he didn't have a chance.
The lie of the land there was exactly the same. He didn't stand a cat in hell's chance.
No, but if you're the Prime Minister and you're trying to cling on to power, you know, just look at it from his point of view.
The Klingon.
Then obviously you don't say, I'm going to resign if you intend to fight. You know, if you're still trying to keep an option to stay on, you don't say, I'm going to resign, do you? Until the point where you're forced to do it. Like no. Margaret Thatcher didn't want to resign, and she said she wasn't going to go. And then in the end she did, because she had to.
I think she was crying, actually, wasn't she?
So was Sarma, if you notice.
Was he?
Yes, in the Commons. Not that Kebby Maiden not cared.
Did you?
Not really, but at that point they do show a bit of humanity, don't they?
They do what?
They do show a bit of humanity at that point, you know.
Anyway, can Burnham make any difference? So let's have a listen to one of the commentators talking about that.
Andy Burnham, now nailed on as Starmer's successor, must urgently learn the lessons from the outgoing leader's mistakes. Starmer, deeply influenced by Mandelson, inherited the Blairite belief that a politician needs to lie to obtain power. Starmer tried to copy the former Prime Minister Tony Blair by turning on the Labour left and cultivating billionaires instead. This meant forming alliances with Britain's far-right media, especially the Murdoch Press. Another mistake. These strategies did work well for Blair. They have proved disastrous for Starmer. Andy Burnham will be in Downing Street soon. He can succeed, and anyone who loves Britain will hope that he does so. But he can only succeed by reverting to a different kind of politics. He stands a chance because, most paradoxically, unlike Starmer and Blair, he is not a natural member of the metropolitan elite. Like Harold Wilson in the 1960s and 70s, Burnham comes from the north. His father was a telephone engineer and his mother a receptionist. Burnham has been a great success as mayor of Manchester. So long as he remembers to govern in the interests of ordinary people and not billionaires, to keep his integrity, resist blandishments, and to be himself, Bonham does stand a chance of succeeding where so many others have recently failed. All reasonable and decent people should be on his side. It's time that Britain had a decent Prime Minister, and we've never needed one more.
So that's Peter O'Bourne there giving us his point of view. He's a very hopeful Martin. We like to think, don't we, that these people do offer some sort of hope.
Well, it's natural enough that people should feel like that. I mean, Peter O'Bourne's had a pretty long political journey. He started off very much in the Conservative camp. And, you know, he's very much from that side of the field, class, you know, in terms of his social background and everything. So in a way, it's great that he's saying what he's saying. And I've got sympathy for what he's saying there.
Yeah, well, yeah, but is there any substance to it?
Well,
you are rather, I mean, we've already seen this week straight away, his chief of staff is going to be a pro-Israeli.
Yes, what will happen?
Who is this guy?
I don't know offhand the name of the person, Tony. I do pay attention, but I don't kind of remember everything.
No.
The point I would make is that he's got the same constraints on him as Starmer had, which is to do with things like bond markets, Americans, Israelis and all the rest of it. And, of course, we're committed to war with Russia, whoever's the Prime Minister. I think Peter O'Bourne's not very good on Russia, actually, so you may find that in actual fact he wants Biden to actually rearm to fight the Russians. So that might be something that we might disagree about. But what he really needs to do to get people on the side like me is he's got to commit to proportional representation and change the electoral system. Because in the current Overton window, where we got to go first past the post, means there's only certain things you can be discussed. Once you've broken that, then other issues can be raised from outside the current Overton window.
It's quite
things like we shouldn't be going to war with Russia, for
example. Novara Media has got quite a nice picture of James Purnell, who's this guy, he's going to be taking over from the Morgan McSweeney role of super deviator of Downing Street. And so Andy Burnham has chosen a pro-Israel corporate lobbyist as his chief of staff. This guy has led a firm representing the arms trade, and he's pro-Israel. So we all know where this prime ministerial ship is going to be coming from, don't we? It'll be pro-arms and pro-Israel.
I'm afraid it will, Tony, which is why he's got to commit to proportional representation, as I've just said, so that other voices can be heard. And that,
this,
then, of course,
guy,
he can
this
just
guy,
be in the
this guy won't be advising
be to
him,
his left.
This guy won't be advising him to do that, will he?
Well, I don't know, Tony.
He won't, because he's from the corporate lobbyists.
Well,
another, I mean, you know, we've had quite a warm week, as you probably noticed. The water companies, who are responsible for a lot of the problems over the last few months, just literally water running out of the, not running out of their taps. And he's one of the people who has been representing those. I mean, he's quite firmly in the genocidal arms and corporate camp.
Well, I mean, we're picking up on this straight away. And, of course, Burnham's got to realise that people are picking up on this straight away. If he wants to get green voters to switch back to the Labour Party, he's got to give them some red meat. I mean, red vegan meat. I mean, I don't know what I mean.
Actually, even
this
guy's...
He's going to have to...
Even James Purnell's client list is secret. The company won't say who they work for.
Well, that's the kind of people that end up running lots of things, isn't it? Maybe what we need is to not have elections anymore, but just everybody vote in their workplaces for their own delegates, and then those delegates vote for other delegates, and we don't have to have prime ministers.
He's never represented politicians, this guy. He has represented Glencore, though, for example.
Yes, well, maybe he's a very poor choice. It's a bad sign.
Is it, is it really in Burnham's choice, or do you think he's been told, this is your guy?
I think what happens when in this situation, he's got some wriggle room, but it's, of course, everybody's beating a path to his door to tell him what he can't do. Yeah? You can't, for example, there will be everybody will be saying you cannot possibly question the fact that we've got to rearm to fight Russia. We all know we've got to do that, don't we? And of course, there's nobody out there in the mainstream who's saying anything else. Maybe Jeremy Corbyn.
Is he? Yeah, but he's being kept off the mainstream.
Well, that's right.
Isn't
there
he?
You are.
Yeah.
So, in other words, we can't talk about the important stuff. So we can all have a big, you know, all this. This is theatre. The reality is that the Israelis are going to wreck this peace agreement. The war is going to go on.
Also,
and if you carry on supporting Israel,
I mean,
you're going to be a Labour Party member,
Clive Lewis, and people like that are not even in the running. It does seem as if nobody's going to be stepping forward to challenge him.
Well, that's because it's easier for the Labour Party, if he looks like the front runner, to just put him in there and let him have a go.
It's like a substitution on a football field, you know? He looks like the front runner, but it looks to me as if he's only being the front runner because the press have been talking him up all the time.
Well, that's what you do if you're a prime minister. You try and get the press to talk about
you. The press have decided to talk about him.
Yes.
Clive Lewis has not been able to persuade the press to talk about him,
Lewis hasn't thrown his hat into the ring because
he's not been talked up by the press.
No,
this is what I'm trying to get. The point I'm trying to make.
Clive Lewis is whoever the
press back to be the new leader, they seem to be the person who becomes the new leader. It's not just whoever would make a good leader or wants to become leader, it's whoever the press back. And people can smell the coffee. It's burn. Everyone's talking about Burnham, 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 so it's got to be Burnham.
Yes. And unfortunately, that's the way capitalist politics works. You have to get your name out
there.
What
about Labour politics? What about Labour politics?
Well, Labour politics has changed quite a lot since the days of the block vote and Clause 4, Tony. It's changed quite a lot because, in actual fact, it's been modernised in all sorts of ways. You've got to have PR people now. They never even bothered to have PR people in the past. What do you need PR people for? I don't know. Why do you need PR people?
Well, To take over as your chief of staff.
Well, there you are. So you do need them then. So
you
could,
no, you don't.
You could send the English
team.
I am being ironic. You could send the English team to the World Cup, but with no manager. They can just work it out on their own in the changing room.
A better job. Who knows?
Well, they might. Anyway, they might. Yeah, let's do that.
Anyway, another person who's been saying everyone seems to think Andy Burnham's wonderful all of a sudden because they all want him
to give.
He's
got his 5 minutes.
They want him to give them jobs.
Just coming up to 20 past 10 Thursday morning, Gareth Barlow with you on Sky News, and the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has said that she backs Andy Burnham, who she believes will be the next Prime Minister. Speaking to our very own Sophie Rich, she told the British Chambers of Commerce Conference in London that her fiscal discipline is working and that the new Makerfield MP is committed to continuing it.
Andy Burnham, who will be the next Prime Minister, has been really clear that he is committed to those fiscal rules. And that is a good thing because it means that businesses here can be confident that stability, that rigour to policy making, that tight grip on the public finances, which is essential for getting inflation and interest rates down, will be continued.
I'm really interested to talk a bit more about the fiscal discipline side of things, which obviously has been a big part of your chancellorship. But, you know, you've come out there and addressed the elephant in the room. You're saying that Andy Burnham is going to be the next Prime Minister. Do you want to be his Chancellor?
Well, those would be choices for him. I'm not going to preempt those. When he becomes Prime Minister, he will make those decisions around the top team around him. But I'm not going to preempt that. Those are his decisions.
I might ask a slightly different way. Do you feel you have unfinished business as Chancellor then?
Well, I'm really proud of my record, and I think in those 2 years, if you look at, first of all, those key macro numbers on inflation, on interest rates, on economic growth, the fact that wages have risen faster than inflation for every single month that I've been Chancellor of the Exchequer.
So that's Rachel from Customer Service, who's making it absolutely clear he is going to be the next Prime Minister. There's no doubt about it. Is that democratic? What do you as a Labour Party member think about the idea that you're not going to get a say in this?
Well, I would probably have voted for him anyway. So there you are. And of course, what the rules are, if you're going to be in a party, they
against
have rules.
Against who? Who else might be standing?
Wes Streeting had his eye on it, but he's got no chance because he would never have got past the membership.
What about Rach?
No chance. I mean, the membership do have a. The membership never used to get a vote in it, Tony. Yeah? That was Ed Miliband who brought that in. Okay? So in actual fact, the way things are decided in political parties is actually a bit of a mystery. How are things decided in Reform, for example? They do not, in fact, have a democratic structure at all.
We're talking about the new
Prime
Minister and the
Labour Party.
Okay, so let's talk about
the Labour Party structure then.
Maybe we should talk about Reform, because it is exactly 10 years since the Brexit referendum and all those people saying, what a shame, and all those other people cheering. So Reform's great leader, Farage, has made a statement this week.
Well, I'm not happy with UK growth, but our growth since Brexit, since that vote, is higher than Italy, Germany and France. But the realistic expectations of millions of people who turned out to vote, who don't normally vote, which gave us that big turnout, is that immigration numbers would be reversed. And frankly, the Boris wave, something the Johnson government was completely in charge of, is seen by many of us, myself included, as a total betrayal of the trust that was placed in them. Constitutionally, we've left. And I don't believe there's a chance of that being reversed. And of course, what the Starmer government was doing and what the next Prime Minister will probably do is to align us more closely with the European Union. That job has been made easier for them because the Conservatives didn't take us away. I mean, Kemi Badenoch, funny enough, she was the minister who could, at the stroke of a pen, have got rid of vast numbers of European laws, but chose not to do it. So the fact we hadn't moved away as far as we ought to have done makes it easier for a Labour government to take us back close. But all the while, we own the status quo. The Leavers own the status quo. We can roll all of this back. And yes, it'll mean tough negotiations. And yes, it'll mean some arguments. And yes, it's going to mean some rows. But we have to exercise the freedoms that we've got. And that applies to business regulation and so many other things. I think the Rejoin the European Union lobby is a remarkably small one, mostly based in central London, and they haven't got a chance of winning. It isn't going to happen. We've left. We're not going back. I'm not even sure they would want us back. And if we did try and go back, it would mean joining the euro, massive contributions of up to £20 billion every year. In any public debate, there's no way voters would buy that. So we're about to have our sixth Prime Minister in 7 years, our seventh in 10. We used to mock Italy, having a new Prime Minister every year. We're now in that position. Truth of what happened is, Brexit was an earthquake in British politics. I've been promising that for some years before. And we're still seeing the aftershocks. Why is Starmer gone? Well, yes, he wasn't up to the job. But on May the 7th, we wiped the Labour Party out in the Northwest, the Northeast, Yorkshire, parts of the West Midlands, bits of South Wales. They were all traditional Labour areas, but they were all Brexit voting areas. And so the two-party system just has not survived Brexit. And I think we're seeing the beginnings of a total reorientation of the British political system. It's not about Brexit as such. It's about the thought processes that led to you either supporting Leave or Remain. It's totally transformed British politics. At the moment, it looks ungovernable, but it will sort itself out.
Well, that's Nigel's version of reality, if you like. He keeps saying there's going to be change. The same change I'm talking about is proportional representation. Then it's not a two-party system anymore, is it, Nigel? Let's move on from that. So yeah, we've got more than two parties.
Yeah.
That's okay.
I mean, what about the substantive points he's making, such as the Conservatives, when Boris was in charge, simply didn't get the European rules out of the system?
Well, the European rules are what allow our businesses to carry on selling into the European market. And as far as we diverge from those rules, we won't be able to sell into that market. This is a decision for private businesses. Like, we could have reinstated the kite marks. Remember British kite marks? There was a big hope that we could do that, and we'd have full British standards for everything. But business came straight back and said, no, we've already got to fulfil European regulations.
So otherwise, I suppose the European Union. The Europeans have kind of got their own kite marks.
Well, yes, they've got their own standards, which is now standard in all of our production processes. And we're not going to chuck that away because we'll lose business. And we have, in fact, lost business. When he said that...
GDP is up, he said.
No, it's not true, though, is it? In actual fact, the latest studies show that we've lost between 6 and 8% of GDP over 10 years. Now, that's not a lot, but that's billions of pounds worth of lost taxation, for example, which means that we can't possibly fix all the potholes. So, in actual fact, Brexit has been, no doubt about
I think you know the economics of it is if we were to go for the Keynesian type of economics, there's no problem fixing the potholes.
No,
actually,
no, because we're a small island which is actually
so you can't
dependent
fix potholes.
On international trade, Tony.
So we can give tax breaks to big companies like Amazon, but we can't fix potholes.
Yes,
if we can't talk about Brexit without you losing your rag because you didn't win I think we need to just maybe move off the topic. Because I know for a fact that if we wanted to fix potholes in this country, we could. But you would much rather blame it, the fact that we aren't doing it, on Brexit.
No, what the real problem is the banking collapse which led to Brexit. What Brexit was 10 years of talking about nothing important. It only cost 10%, say 8% of our GDP over 10 years. That's not a lot, really. But that is the margin in which governments actually operate and decide what their priorities are. Now, we could, of course, now we're outside the European Union, reintroduce exchange controls so that nobody can take money out of the country, like in the 1950s, Tony. So no buying foreign property abroad.
If you remember rightly, when we were doing this programme at BCFM, we had a bit of a spoof one week where we said exactly that. The government has just announced they're introducing exchange controls this weekend, and anyone who cannot move their money around anymore.
Well, there was even discussion of doing that in Greece, for example, at one stage.
Well, of course, this is a normal thing.
Yes, once you've got rid of exchange controls, and Britain pushed for everybody to do that, not just Britain, we rammed it down everybody's throat.
You can only do it yourself, actually.
Well, no, even if you do it yourself.
Individual countries could the only one, you know.
Yeah, but an individual small country can't do it very easily, okay? It's actually
nothing
quite tricky.
Worth doing is easy in this
No,
life.
It's not. Sometimes you have to actually fight for sovereignty.
It seems to
not
me.
Just have a referendum. You have to kill people to drive them out of your country.
Yes, Martin.
Your sovereignty, it's a big deal. Yeah. And all this immigration stuff and foreigners, it can lead to all sorts of othering and conflict. Let's come back to the immigration issue.
Brexit therapy.
Yeah, I probably do. And Brexit therapy would be to go back in the single market and have
maybe just a glass of water over your head.
And free movement of white people from Europe, because what's happened since Brexit is because our social care system and our national health service aren't properly funded, we have to bring people in to do that work.
None of this is because of Brexit.
No, it's because we've not funded the national health service.
All of this is because we have decided that we're not going to fund decent social services in this country of any sort.
That's because,
and we're handing them all over to private individuals.
That's because Margaret Thatcher, who hated the European Union, as you well know, and encouraged us to hate it, she cut all the taxes for wealthy people, and they don't want to go back to paying any more. It's become unthinkable to talk about it. But in the boring 1950s, when we weren't in the European Economic Community, the top rate of tax in this country was 95%. And you couldn't just take your money away, either.
Anyway, going back
to the good old days. Let's get back to the good old days. I'm sure Nigel's in favour of that.
Oh, I bet he's not.
Oh, I bet he's not.
No, he's not. But anyway, so getting back to Starmer's resignation and Burnham's coronation, it does make you wonder about if there is any democracy left in the Labour Party, doesn't it?
Well, I think it's what it is they're playing within the rules as they exist. And what was the democracy in the Labour Party before? We had a syndicalist structure where conference decided the policy.
Well, you had a system where Tony Benn nearly became your leader.
That's right. But there was he didn't manage to succeed because of the various
ways. Has the system now changed so much that Jeremy Corbyn and Pitt or someone like him could never become leader again?
No, it hasn't changed completely. But of course, Corbyn's been kicked out so that he can't throw his hat back into the ring.
I think a lot of it seems to be focused around the national executive, doesn't it?
Yes,
and
that's right.
Who is on the national executive?
That's right. So the national executive elections are
so
the
they
key.
Would have been deciding, oh yes, Burnham, I think Burnham, Burnham, Burnham. And they've manoeuvred the whole party and the country into the situation where, as Rachel Reeves has just said, Burnham will be the next Prime Minister. We've had Prime Minister's questions this week. It's most likely to be Starmer's last. So I know we don't normally do that or do it on here, Martin. Would you like to hear a few little bits of Prime Minister's questions?
Well, I love Prime Minister's questions, as you know, Tony. It's one of my favourite things.
Jack Blake.
Yeah. Mr
Speaker, the first duty of His Majesty's government, indeed the Prime Minister's first duty, is the defence of the realm. The Prime Minister is not responsible for the worsening geopolitical situation, but he is responsible for this country's reaction to it. It is imperative that we can outline to our allies at the Ankara NATO summit early next month how we will meet that situation. There were reports yesterday that he is being pushed to delay again the defence investment plan by the new member for Makerfield's Outriders. Will he confirm to this House that he will push ahead with its publication, confirm that it is fully funded to the level the Chief of Defence Staff said is required, and not to the level his former Defence Secretary resigned over, and in doing so, fulfil his first duty to defend the realm?
Yeah.
That's the first duty the last government spectacularly failed at.
because they hollowed out our armed forces. We've already delivered the biggest sustained boost in defence spending since the 80s. That's £270 billion over this Parliament. We will increase that with the Defence Investment Plan, which will be published before the NATO summit.
Right, so it's going to come out before the NATO summit. This is one of the main little problems. I don't know, if you were fighting in the British Armed Forces, would you have any confidence that they knew how to pay for you?
Well, basically, the British Armed Forces is a relatively minor thing in the big scheme of things these days. We shouldn't be actually going looking for trouble and then spending money on trying to solve it. The Overton window in this country, everybody across the political spectrum believes that we need to spend more on weaponry. That is simply wrong. That's one of the reasons why we've got no money
for
anything
else. Well, I'm not
sure
they do. I think a lot of the...
Most ordinary people might not agree.
A lot of the commentators and voters over the last few years have been saying, well, actually, why are we spending money on defence when actually the real problem is the cost of living crisis?
Yes, and the cost of living crisis has been caused by our American allies blowing up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline and dragging into a war with the Ukraine. What we really need to do is get our sovereignty back from the Americans and stop being told what to do by the Israelis.
This guy,
do you think Nigel wants to do that?
John Healy, the Defence Secretary, resigning, isn't it just simply because he can see the writing on the wall? Starmer's off, and he wants to make sure that he's best placed to be the new Defence Secretary Andy Burnham?
I think these Defence resignations are part of the deep state's plan to make sure that they get their money, yeah? So they put the frighteners on Starmer. You better get some more money in. And they're now putting the frighteners on Burnham. Look, don't think you're going to get away with this. We need more money to spend on American weapons. Because the Americans have told us 5% of GDP. We've got to spend 5% of GDP. And we've got to go for it as soon as possible. And that means we're going to spend loads of money on American weapons, which is what the Americans want. That's our sovereignty. That's what sovereignty is about in this country.
Starmer's last Prime Minister's questions.
Wendy Ball.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. From slashing winter fuel payments to surrendering the Chagos Islands, this Prime Minister has got every major decision wrong. It's no wonder even his own MPs are now looking elsewhere for the answers. So as this may be one of, his final appearances at the dispatch box, will he make one final U-turn? Will he scrap Labour's disastrous grey belt policy and help protect the precious green belt spaces and green areas across Aldridge Brownhills? And if not, his legacy will be one that he was the Prime Minister who destroyed so many of our local communities.
I do like the Right Honourable Lady, and when she talks about destroying and legacies, I remember she was the chief whip, I think, to Liz Truss. I'm very proud that we are building the houses that we need so that everyone has a base camp for their opportunity and their aspiration. Something last government failed on and we're succeeding on.
Is it okay to build all over the countryside, the green belt?
Well, I'm not very much in favour of it. I think what should happen is that second homes should be confiscated and rented out to homeless people.
Well, and proper taxes on large homes, then... You know, then you wouldn't even need to have any rates on the small homes, would you?
Yes, and also, of course, we don't really need to build loads of new housing. There's plenty of potential housing out there. We just need to put poor people into it. But then the rich people have to lose something.
And this is what they call affordable housing.
Well, I know, but as we know,
it's not affordable. This is the trouble.
There's all sorts of studies that have shown that this makes no difference at all to people at the bottom of the housing market. The problem isn't a lack of supply of housing. This country's overbuilt. We've got masses of... Go up to Clifton, you can walk around, there's great big housing, nobody in it.
What about the millions of migrants that have arrived over the last decade or so? Well, where are they going to live, in a field?
Well, that's right. So in other words...
No,
they're living in private rented like I am, Tony. Yeah.
Well, so there is a demand for housing, isn't
there? Yes, there is, but that means that the rents for everybody are massively increased. And of course the same thing happens.
The demand for housing is increasing, which suits the landlord classes.
It is, but also of course don't forget that another thing that forces up house prices, especially in places like London and Bristol, is wealthy people come here and buy second, third, fourth homes. We should just ban that, shouldn't we? Should the Saudi princes be able to drive up the rents in East London? No. People shouldn't be allowed to go and buy houses in other people's countries, should they? There should be rules about it, like there are in New Zealand.
Also, having multiple homes in their own country should be heavily taxed.
That's right. We should tax away second homes and third homes for everybody, shouldn't we? One home each.
The trouble is, Martin, what's happened here is property has become less somewhere to live and more somewhere to invest in for
that's
so
right.
many.
And that's, and of course, that investment is very good for the individuals who are making it. They're not actually making a productive contribution, but they're getting money out of it, and it's brilliant for the city.
One of the things I'd love
brilliant
to see,
all
I'd
this
love
money
to see
with.
Done properly is, I mean, I did do have a go at this once. Gosh, must be about maybe nearly a decade ago, to look at how much a home costs to buy, as against how much it costs to build. I mean, it's just totally ridiculous how, you know, the number of man hours and the materials that go into building a house. What you're getting is you're getting something which is two or three times the cost of what it is, simply because of the investment in the land value and the speculation and the land value underneath it.
The land value underneath it is the key thing.
Yeah.
And of course, what that should all be taxed away and used as the tax base of the country. But that would wipe out the Crown Estates, for example. It would wipe out the Duke of Westminster.
Good. Good.
Yeah, well, that would be good. Now, Andy Burnham could put that sort of thing forward.
Oh,
do you think he will?
Oh.
Maybe Zach Polanski will.
Yeah, but Zach Polanski won't have power
unless there's a PR, and then he could hold the balance of power, couldn't he?
Maybe.
Easy, easy peasy.
Martin Root. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. US big tech has exploited us for far too long. So I'm delighted that the Met Police followed my advice and pushed Apple and Google to implement the stolen handset blacklist, curbing resales and cutting mobile theft by almost half. Likewise, does the Prime Minister agree it's time to stand up to social media companies and reclassify them from platforms to publishers, holding them responsible for the harmful and addictive content that they recommend, promote and profit from?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I thank him for his question. He will have seen the action we're taking in relation to social media. The social media ban for under-16s, which has been welcomed by families across the country, strengthening the Online Safety Act to tackle intimate images, abuse and cyber flashing, and closing loopholes in chatbots, and taking on Grok. But there's more to do.
Taking on Grok. This is the sort of thing that comes up at Prime Minister's questions here. What do you make of their tech strategy? And there seems to be an increasing idea that, well, we don't really need police, and, you know, we never really did need them on the beat because we've got drones and Palantir that can do the police's job for them.
Well, Palantir shouldn't be allowed to get any foothold in our public services, because once they're in, and everything has to be done to suit them. And of course, they are basically the deep state, the US deep state, controlling everything that goes on in our country. We need sovereignty. I'm with Nigel on that one. We need to get out of the US alliance. We need their bases out. Did you see this week? This woman was raped by a US Air Force officer, and it was all tried on the base, and he got 6 months and a slap on the wrist because they run this country.
Talk about that in a little bit of detail, because that's horrifying. Because that isn't that American airbase is not America.
It was Lake and Heath.
Lake and Heath.
So what happened was he met up on Tinder with this local woman. She went back to his place. Eventually, it turned out that he raped and abused her. But he was arrested, and then he was handed over to his own people for punishment. So, in actual fact, he was given a court martial inside the base. Although, in actual fact, the offence had happened in the house, which was in Cambridgeshire, and he should have been tried under British law. He wasn't. He got 6 months in solitary and a slap on the wrist. If he'd been tried in a British court, he'd probably gone to prison.
Well, the woman he raped, Sarah Steele, has waived her anonymity to call for greater scrutiny of how US military courts are allowed to rip apart vulnerable witnesses in the UK. Why did a US fighter pilot avoid the British trial after strangling a woman in England? So this is by Harry Davis and Rob Evans in The Guardian, I think today, yeah. Even.
Yes.
Because there's been several articles about this. So she could have stayed anonymous, but she decided to go to these Guardian journalists and talk about it all. A woman strangled by an American fighter pilot at his home in an English city has come forward to criticise the handling of his prosecution via a US court-martial. Process she described as military first, justice second. She's a British academic. She came forward to speak about the distressing and degrading experience she had with the US military justice system after she was assaulted by the airmen in Cambridge. Although Jacob Wolfson assaulted Steele on UK soil, after the pair met on a dating app, American military police quickly took over the case. The pilot was tried by US Air Force prosecutors and an all-male jury.
Yes, and of course, if it had been tried in a British court, she might have been able to keep her anonymity as well, because she had to face off with this guy. She'd have been able to testify behind the screen and all sorts of things. Anyway, that's a minor issue, really, compared to the big issue, what that base is doing there at all, because they use it to bomb other countries without asking us. And of course, those other countries might come back and kill our civilians. So maybe we should have some say over things like that. Italy refused to allow. Italy's got a pro-fascist government. I mean, Meloni's Fratelli d'Italia is a, you know, Mussoliniite party. But even they refused to allow the Americans to use their air bases to attack Iran.
What about the French? What about the French? The what about the Spanish?
They've got no bases in France because de Gaulle kicked them out. The Spanish also said you can't do it. Britain said, okay. Well, we did, they didn't even bother to ask us. It's not a question of us saying, OK, they just did it, because they know that we're a doormat.
Somebody should
tell Nigel.
I mean, I think it's interesting what you've said there about the this idea of having having the US... I mean, they are basically treating it as if it's their own country, aren't they?
Yes, and effectively it is. Who do you think really runs this country? There's a lot of silliness in there. Andy Byrne, do you think Andy Byrne runs this country?
No.
No.
Who?
The United States Deep State runs this country. They were probably behind 7-7. And the MI5 were probably involved as well, as you know.
I think more the Israelis.
And the Israelis, yes. And, of course, they're all in it, aren't they? They're the ones who tell us what to do in this country. Meanwhile, we have silly arguments about silly stuff.
Right, so back in 2002, we had the murders of Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman just outside the same base, in the run-up to the Iraq War.
Well, they have real problems with this in Okinawa in Japan, because they've been based there for years, and their behaviour with local people is absolutely appalling. Wherever the US is based, there are massive kind of issues with things like rape of minors.
Is it possible that the Americans are recruiting psychopaths to their armed forces?
I think that's the ones they're looking for. You know, that's really the truth of it. Who else do you think volunteers to go and fight in the US Army? They've been lowering the standards of, you know, at one stage they wouldn't take you if you've got a criminal record, but they stopped doing that ages ago because they couldn't get anybody. And of course, this also has a long-term effect. A lot of these ICE, goons in the US are not actually, you know, they're ex-military, and they've got no training.
I think it's worth reminding everybody that the so-called murderer of Holly and Jessica himself was killed. He didn't actually finish his sentence. Somebody managed to get into some apparently high security prison and bludgeon him to death. Very convenient, isn't it? That the guy who's supposed to have done this murder outside Lake and Heath, double murder, never survived jail.
Yes, but your presumption that it was...
I'm not so presuming anything here. Yeah. Isn't it interesting that he never made it out of jail?
Well,
also that someone has managed to smuggle something to kill him into jail. Who arranged for that?
Well, what you'll find is that quite a lot of these people are under segregation, under rule, whatever it is, and, of course, they're permanent targets. You see this guy, this teacher...
What I will do on this week's
for killing an 18-year-old boy... He is going to have a very hard time in prison. He's going to be in solitary confinement the rest of his life.
What I'll make sure happens is that I'll put a link up to the Holly Wells, Jessica Chapman case, because I remember years ago, and I don't know if anybody has got a copy of this, it would be lovely if you had, a guy called Dave Starbuck, I kid you not, he was he's a radio, I think he was a DJ and journalist, maybe just a journalist, but back in the 1990s he used to put loads of good stuff. Another person who did a very good a piece on this. I think, was it Walter Veith? Oh, I can't remember the guy's name. But anyway, there was a US writer that did a brilliant take pulling apart of the Holly and Jessica case. And so I'll put a make sure I put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk too. And also I'll send that out as part of our newsletter at the weekend, because this is really important, this idea that the Americans have got these bases here with psychopaths in who are killing British people, and then the British court system and the Justice Secretary or whoever it is just covering these crimes up. At the very least, of course, this would spark an outrage in the local area and possibly a national outrage, Martin, to call for the Americans to be kicked out of this country.
Well, I think lots of people have just got used to them being here, and the idea of them going is like losing a comfort blanket. But ultimately, that is the future for this country.
The American Air Force is a comfort blanket, is it?
Well, in actual fact, as they found out in the Gulf States, in actual fact, having a US base on your territory is actually a foolishness. It means that America's enemies regard you as their enemy. Maybe we should just be neutral, Finland used to be.
As America starts to fall down the ranks of the powerful in the world, it becomes more and more likely that you're going to get a boot treading on your head because of your helping these Americans.
Well, that's right. I mean, the whole global political system is in a kind of transitional phase. You know, this is World War territory.
It's called Pax Zionica. That's what I call it anyway. Some call it Judaica.
Well, it's not a Pax, though, is it? That's the problem.
Well, there is. If you do as you're told and you do exactly as you're told, then there won't be any war.
But if you don't
do as you're told, if you start thinking for yourself, then crash, bang, wallop is the order of the day. So we were talking a little bit about the tech side of things. There's also quite a good piece this week about Palantir's use in the police force.
Drones hovering above your neighbourhood, cameras scanning your face on the high street, and AI trawling through thousands of images in seconds. If you thought Britain was already a surveillance state, the Met Police have just announced the biggest expansion of technology that London has ever seen.
Policing today will fail if it is not allowed to keep pace with criminals through the use of technology. That's not a prediction for the distant future. It's a present reality.
Sir Mark says that while police budgets poured money into officers, not technology, criminals have done the opposite, and now police are playing catch-up. So drones will be rolled out to every London borough by this time next year, and live facial recognition, in trial since 2024, will be expanded across central London, despite fears that the technology is an invasion of privacy and could be racially biased.
The Home Office, you will know, accepted 6 months ago that facial recognition software can lead to instances of black and brown people being misidentified and targeted at higher rates than white members of the population. Do you accept their findings that can happen?
We were so concerned about that, we asked the National Standards Body, the National Physical Laboratory, to do an independent evaluation of it, and they came back with their report. Said, yeah, if you operate it within these parameters, it's both accurate, as in high degree of accuracy, very few false positives, and it's fair. It's equally accurate, sort of male, female, black, white.
And then there's the Met's intended rollout of AI software by the controversial US firm Palantir, which the Met believes is the best product to integrate its thousands of disparate data sets to spot patterns at the touch of a button and solve cases much faster.
Sadiq Khan has said he doesn't want you to use Palantir. He's been very clear about that. So where are you at with that?
So we've said all we need to say about this. The Mayor and I are both keen on technology that helps do the best for policing of London.
But can you understand that perhaps he and other people have an issue with Palantir given their use in Iran, potentially Gaza, for the ICE enforcement in America?
You can pick over the issues we've talked about publicly as much as you want. I've got nothing to add to this. The intent remains the same. We're not wedded to a particular supplier. We just want the best technologies to protect London's communities, and we'll keep pursuing them.
He clearly didn't want to talk Palantir, not least because the company is now suing Sadiq Khan. But the whole row underscores what some believe is the Met's rush to adopt new technology without proper consultation.
Sir Mark at times has seemed a little bit more like a salesperson for Palantir and other tech companies. These companies are sometimes building their products off the back of information that we're giving them within policing, and we're not really 100% sure exactly what they're actually using that for at times. So, you know, the companies are there to make money, to make profits. Policing is there to keep everybody safe.
Despite those fears, the Commissioner says slowing down is not an option. Britain's biggest police force is pressing ahead, and where it leads, the rest of the country is bound to follow.
So there you go. This is Palantir, and but he really doesn't want to talk about that, does he? And quite clearly, and you know why?
Why, Tony?
Because legal. Well, if I say something nasty about Palantir, they're going to come sue me.
Well, they are obviously suing Sadiq Khan because he's put his foot down and said they can't be used in London. The real problem with Palantir and all these tech companies, you know, who are the heart of the deep state now in the US, is they are the heart of the deep state, and they're going to get access to all of our criminal data, all of it, and their computers can go through all of it at any point. Do we trust these people to have control of that data? The answer is no. What we should have been doing is developing our own systems, which are unique to us and are irreplaceable, which are owned by the government, not by the private sector, and not to make a profit. Now, that, of course, requires to have some money to pay for it. We're back to the whole thing of having taxes on wealthy people again, aren't we, instead of going to the cheaper options.
So, anyway, Sadiq Khan has said there's a breach of procurement rules in the contract with Palantir and suggested they had been the only contender. Palantir's lawyers have written to the mayor's office saying that they intend to challenge the decision in the courts. Khan's office has confirmed they'd received the letter. Palantir declined to comment for this article, says The Guardian. So a spokesman for Khan's office says the Met did not present its procurement strategy as required, and the Met only fully engaged with one potential supplier, Palantir.
Well, I mean, that's a pretty good reason for saying we're not going to let this go through if he's got the power to
ban it. Why are the Met so keen on this stuff?
The Met are, in terms of the British police force, they are the closest to the deep state. The special demonstration squad was set up by the Met, but it operated
who
all over the country.
Was
it? It was actually run by MI5.
Who was it that was pushing for this? And at the Metropolitan Police, who Sadiq Khan had this discussion with, saying, no, I don't think we're going to have this because it's not good enough. It was a chappie. It wasn't with Mark Rowley, who we heard there, the Met Commissioner. It was the present Met Commissioner. They change very regularly. It was a guy called Matt Dukes. Now, Matt Dukes is the Assistant Chief Constable of the Metropolitan Police. He's also responsible for counter-terrorism.
Yeah.
He's also responsible for detention of George Galloway, of Richard Medhurst, of Asa Yes. Winstanley,
Yes.
and a whole list of other Yes. journalists that have been detained at our airports when they arrive. So he's a bit of a suspect himself, isn't he? He's supposed to be Yeah. a copper. But as far as I'm concerned, the guy's a suspect. Matt Dukes Yes. is his name. Yes. Matt Dukes, in case you hadn't heard it before.
Yeah.
He also used to be the chief constable for South Wales Police, who covered up those Clindach murders,
Right.
if you remember. Do you remember the murder of a whole family
Yes.
Around about 2000, and there were various people that tried to push for him to be intervening, to say, well, hang on, this is one of your police officers that's done these murders, and you found an autistic guy, fitted them up, put them in jail, and they're now dead. So, but your policeman who actually carried out the Clindach murders is still walking the streets, Matt Dukes.
Yes, well, you've obviously got your beady eyes on Matt Dukes.
Well, anyway,
do you know where he lives, Tony?
Well, look, I don't look.
Maybe
I'm not that sort of person, but I'm absolutely livid that this is the same guy who wants Palantir, who's been detaining all of these human rights journalists and some of the best journalists Yes. in the world.
Yes.
What on earth is this? Who is this guy, and why on earth has he not got the handcuffs on him?
Well, that's right. And I think the police service,
I started shouting and got a bit angry there. Both of us can do this from time to time.
It's the weather.
Is it okay with you? Is it okay with you,
Martin? It's the weather.
It's a little bit warm.
Yes. Well, I mean, I don't know who was speaking in the clip there, but they had a Belfast accent about, what the police service is supposed to be about, They're not there to make a profit. They're there to keep everybody safe. And, of course, the police service of Northern Ireland was completely rebuilt from the Royal Ulster Constabulary. Royal Ulster Constabulary was disbanded.
There is a move.
Police service of Northern Ireland.
There is
maybe we need to do that with Metropolitan Police.
To get rid of people and to replace them with AI. And this, it seems to me, is simply so that evil maniacs like Elon Musk and Peter Thiel can sit there and twiddle with their computer and say, right, arrest this cohort of people. They can click on a particular person, yeah, and they can go down to the bottom of the page. They can press the shift key, click on that, highlight them all, and the drones will come for them.
That's right. I mean, and don't forget that all of these Silicon Valley companies have ultimately been dependent on government money. They've never produced anything that would actually sell in a market, a free market, where people made a decision, would we like to buy this or not? So they've actually been built up.
I suppose
in the
only one potential contractor is not a free market.
Well, that's normal stuff in the United States. Okay? And that's where they're going. And of course, once they're embedded into the official structure, which is the state structure, you can't get them out. Yeah? I do not imagine that the Russians allow, that they do have similar systems, obviously, but they're actually run by the Russian government for obvious reasons. They do subcontract some things out, but most of the important stuff.
And you'll find almost always
they're not getting Palantir.
Almost always these meetings are open to the public, and the minutes are published, and all this sort of thing. What we've moved into in this world of bringing all these sort of corporate procurement is secrecy. Well, this is being done to you.
It's yes, because it's commercially confidential. You see, Tony, that's the way you get around that. Commercially confidential.
Neil Oliver, I know he's not one of your favourite people, but he had something to say about this whole business of government trying to regulate the tech industry this week.
My kids and my kids' friends talk about how they've already seen the future of AI. They already know that AI has got where it is only by harvesting and copying and repurposing what actual, real people have already done. Musicians, authors, creative and inventive people of every sort. Kids already know that AI has gone as far as it's going to go, that it's already cannibalizing output from other AI. The fake and the error-ridden and the just plain crap is being cheerfully, mindlessly recycled and repurposed by more AI. Error begetting error. Weakness begetting weakness. You'd have to be blind or willfully blind, not to see how this ends, how the snake inevitably, and like it does in the oldest stories, ends up eating itself from the tail to the head. And I say again, this observation is coming from the very youngsters a fraudster like Starmer claims he wants to protect by banning them from the social media from which they learned all of this truth in the first place. Talk about hoist by your own petard. The state, the dying state, a diseased and infected entity, if ever there was one, and only the most obvious, visible part of the greater disease of totalitarianism or centralization of dictatorship, is manned by the most frightened people the world has yet seen. The would-be totalitarians are frightened enough of their own shadows, but they're certainly terrified of us. I've said before that the most telling trait of psychopaths is their utter lack of empathy, which means that while they're obsessed with human beings and appalled and therefore terrified of human beings, they simply cannot do human themselves. They signally fail to pass themselves off as fully human. It's the one thing they can't do and the only thing they can't buy or even steal. Watching the terrified totalitarians watching us being human is like watching a frightened cat being carried through an airport terminal in one of those little plastic crates, wide-eyed and hissing at everything it sees and cannot comprehend. This is why they need control. This is why they would replace the wonder of humankind and human nature and all of that unpredictable and limitless potential of real people with a digital alternative, with what we are battered into calling AI. Artificial intelligence. The problem the totalitarians have, The Achilles heel that is already their undoing is that the pesky people have long since worked it all out, seen what's going on, and in so doing, identified the psychos. All they have left is to shut us down, or rather, shut us up. They see us talking on social media, the same platforms they themselves launched to harvest all of our private data in the first place. They see us talking on there, talking about the psychos, about the control freaks, the perverts, and what they're doing. And it utterly terrifies them. That's what this latest move, fronted by factotums and stooges like Starmer, is all about. It's about seizing control of the means by which we talk to each other about them and about what they're doing. And what, most importantly, they're trying to do. And so we get what we've got. The latest transparent bid to use the false flag of endangered children as cover for a last-ditch bid on behalf of corrupt entities once and for all to silence dissent and control the people instead. Again, I say, just, finally, and forever, if you would, you pathetic bunch of artificial idiots, just go away.
Well, they're not going away, are they? Because if they were going away, then they might end up in jail. It's a bit like we were just hearing from the police, which is this idea that, oh, well, the criminals have got this technology. Nobody's actually managed to regulate it in such a way to stop them using AI, etc., to get away, to help them commit crime. And because we've just allowed people like Musk and the other AI, Sam Altman and the rest of them, to just run amok without any kind of regulation, so we're going to have to just sort of buy Palantir like them.
Well, I mean, the situation is obviously contradictory in very many ways. The deep state actually controls all of these things and is actually being pushed by them, and they're part of it. And then pushbacks by the British state or the Australian state to stop under 60. I mean, they've already had this in Australia, and it just hasn't worked because kids can just go around it. How do you enforce it? It's unenforceable. So that's one of the problems. The whole technology is extremely problematic, and as you can see, different internet and AI systems are evolving. So the Chinese and the Russians will not be... They don't allow Western... Silicon Valley type companies into their structure.
One of the points Neil Oliver made there is a very good one. It's basically mass plagiarism. So it's all these ideas that are out there. AI is just scooping them up and replicating them and pinching them, basically, saying that's it's right. Me when it isn't.
Yes, and also, of course, all they're really doing, which human beings find difficult, is they look at everything on the internet that's been said about a particular topic, and they can, because it's, they can look very quickly, they can come to some kind of vague idea about what's going on. But it's not a human judgment, is it? It's not based on real knowledge. What they're doing, what the AI bots are doing, is just looking what everybody else has said and summarising it. Yeah. And that's a useful skill, but in terms of actually, creative thought, it's just, there isn't
any
there.
It's systematic plagiarism. Yeah. That's what it is. It's stealing and borrowing everyone else's ideas and selling them as if they're your own. And amazes me that so many people are just sort of buying into this. I particularly dislike the AI imagery that everybody seems to have just jumped on this bandwagon. I will not click on anything which has got AI imagery on it, apart from the Lego stuff.
Well, there you are,
Iran,
you
which there is very are, well see. Done. If it's well done, that's fine. But yes, to I me, know, most of
Lego,
it is
Lego might have something to say about that.
Yeah, I might get sued. I might get sued for saying that I do like the Lego stuff. Sorry, but I mean the point I'm trying to make very badly is that this just repels me because it's just what it says to me is this person's lazy.
Yes, well, okay. I mean, what's happening in universities?
An AI is lazy, isn't it?
Well, of course, if you get the AI to write your essay, you don't have to do it. I mean, but in actual fact, if you still have an exam where you're not allowed to take a computer or a phone in, you've got to remember it. Yeah? So coursework, we'll have to get rid of coursework.
because that can easily be faked.
Technology is there to help you cheat your way through life, it seems to me.
Well, it's always been like that,
and
hasn't it?
No, you know, none of the options. There are a lot of organisations, we were talking about them last week, like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Big Brother Watchers of this world, who have put forward a whole load of very good ideas saying, look, you know, this is going to be a real problem in the future unless you begin to regulate it now. And the governments have basically caved into these people like Musk.
Well, of course they have. And they don't like this half-hearted attempt to try and control teenage access to the internet in Britain. The US tech companies are absolutely opposed to that. And, you know, they're going to stamp their feet and have a bit of a rage about it until we give in and let them do what they want. But, of course, you know, this is turning into a symbolic struggle. I think both sides are actually way out of line, because I don't think you can actually regulate these things.
Isn't it
going to
be a bit like Prohibition, where they say, no, you can't do it, but all the kids can do it anyway?
Well, that's right. Of course, that's exactly what it's going to be like. Yeah. You can pass laws saying you can't do this, but if you can't enforce them, you might as well not bother.
Oh, these politicians, they're so incompetent. Maybe we should just let the fascists run the show, Martin.
Well, am I supposed to answer that, or have you got a clip?
No. You're supposed to answer it.
All right, well, maybe I could be in charge then.
God, another thing to say. Anyway, look, you were talking last week about Elon Musk and his share flotation. One of my favourites is Ali McForever. She's had a look at Elon Musk and whether or not it's actually possible for him to go to Mars.
Here are all the ways that SpaceX is a scam. Section 1, timeline slipping and scientific incoherence. At the Code conference in 2016, Elon first promised that he would have a mission to Mars within the next 24 months, so by 2018. By September that year, still in 2016, that had slipped already, and he was stating he could get the first flight by 2022. Then in September 2017, he said that he was aiming for 2024. 2018 came and left with zero SpaceX missions launched to Mars. And then 2020 came and left with zero SpaceX missions launched to Mars. 2022, still no space mission to Mars. And by 2024, he posted on X saying that it would actually be 2026. And we are now over halfway through 2026, still no Mars. Now, the SpaceX website says there will be nothing earlier than 2028. Elon cannot go to Mars. The science, NASA's own science, proves this. The radiation alone kills the crew in transit. NASA has a career radiation limit for astronauts. It is a hard ceiling across the astronaut's entire career because exposure to radiation literally makes you die of painful cancer. That limit that NASA sets, you burn through it just on the way out, never mind getting back. This is confirmed in a 2025 peer-reviewed study published in Nature Scientific Reports. You don't get to go twice, you might not get back, and you will barely survive going once. And if there happens to be any kind of solar flare or solar event, then that would deliver a lethal dose in seconds. And you have no warning, they're incredibly unpredictable, and there's no material on Earth that we have yet found that is adequate at shielding from these blasts. In 2018, NASA published research in Nature Astronomy. This research confirmed that terraforming Mars is not possible with any of our present-day technology, and it cannot become possible under any foreseeable development they're aware of. Mars's atmosphere is 0.6% the pressure of Earth's. Mars does not have an atmosphere, and it never will. The surface temperatures on Mars are average minus 63 degrees Celsius. Mars has no magnetic field. Cosmic rays and solar radiation hit the surface of Mars continuously. That radiation will kill you. You are not safe inside of a structure. We do not have any material or technology that can shield you from the explosive radiation of the sun. Colonizing Mars is literally incompatible with the laws of physics. You will never be able to live on Mars. It's not possible. But every rocket that gets launched in the attempt is making this planet less habitable. The Falcon 9 burns RP-1 kerosene. Every single launch of one of these rockets is injecting black carbon, soot, directly into the upper stratosphere. Black soot from rockets that gets deposited in the upper stratosphere doesn't go anywhere. You can't rain it out. It's literally building up. It will block out the sun, which I think is what Mr. Burns wants.
Right. So that's Ali McForever. Just a clip of her longer piece about the viability of this SpaceX. Martin, you seem to be suggesting that the ideas of going to Mars, that people may possibly lose their money. There's yeah. $7.5
Well, I mean,
trillion.
This looks more to me like the South Sea bubble, where we're going to do something, but we can't tell you what it is. Or, I mean, tulips, there is actually a flower at the end of it with a tulip, but Mars, not so much. But I mean, this is extraordinary that people will believe this stuff and put money on this.
What's more extraordinary for me is that the mainstream press don't hold these sorts of criticisms up. This isn't, a lot of the information Ali's put there is NASA's own figures.
Well, that's right. So, in other words, what would be, you know, these people are charlatans, apart from
the journalists, maybe not the journalists, but the editors or the managers of the press are just, it's like groupthink, isn't it? They're all thinking, oh, this Elon Musk, he's so rich, and surely his next project is going to make him even richer,
don't forget, he's a very powerful guy. He sacked loads of US government employees, thousands and thousands of people.
Yeah, and then Trump sacked him.
Well, there you go. So who wants to cross him?
He's not that powerful, though, surely. Well, I mean, depends. If he's coming out with rubbish like this, people are going to start laughing in his face, aren't they?
If you're a journalist in the mainstream, you wouldn't want to cross him, would you?
No, he'd probably get you sacked.
That's right, he would get you sacked,
press a little
he?
Button on his phone, that's and you right. would go down this big tube onto the rocks and the sea.
Yeah.
So it's not happening, no? He can't go to Mars.
Well, no, he can't. What will happen is there's going to be a crash of the bubble and everybody will realise it was all wrong. Nobody believes in the South Sea bubble anymore, Tony.
So what's going on here is people are coming up with ideas that sound good, that they're putting them through public relations firms. And it's almost like, actually, what the press has been doing is an advert for something where they are going to lose their money.
That's right, and this particular share issue, it's got a rather unusual characteristic, which he's rigged it in such a way that things like pension funds, regulated, they can only invest in certain things, and they have to be fairly stable things that they can be guaranteed to get a return on, but he's rigged it so that his stuff falls into this category, and of course they're also under legal obligation, pension funds, to maximise their return, so they get legally drawn in, they've got to take some of these shares as part of what they've got to do, and of course what that means is ordinary people are going to lose their money, even though they don't know they're being invested in it. Others invest their own private money in it, but a fool and his money are soon parted. But the history of capitalism is full of such bubbles. They're not in any way an occasional thing. A lot of capitalism has been based upon basically swindling people out of their money. And, why are people surprised by that?
Hang on, over the years, surely these investments do hold, and people have made a lot of money from them, particularly things like oil shares, mining shares, this sort of thing.
Yeah, but those kind of things are very basic, yeah? That's investing in the money. And even they can go all over the place. Yeah, if the oil price bounces around all over the place, but loads of people may have lost loads of money on that, especially unless they're inside traders and they know what's going to happen. But of course, if you're actually investing in something really useful, which is going to actually be productive, like electric cars, for example, they're potentially useful things. But the point is, this isn't electric. You can't make his electric car company pay.
Isn't it amazing? It's taken a decade for the authorities to say no to lithium batteries. I just see on the news today, they were saying you're not going to be able to take lithium, any kind of lithium battery, onto an aircraft in the future.
Well, that's right.
Because even in your baggage, they can start burning spontaneously.
I think in China,
they should be called spontaneous combustion batteries.
Well, yeah, there've been various fires in Bristol, haven't there?
It was explained to me once by someone that knew about such things why these batteries are so dangerous, and that's because if you know about how a battery works, it's got an anode and a cathode, and it slowly charges up. And what happens when particularly with these electric car batteries, is when you try and put them on a fast charge, the electrodes whizzing through the battery and charging it up actually start to create a sort of tree of metal inside the battery. So I say a tree, but it's like a branch coming out from the anode or the cathode, and they reach into the battery. But it's only if you're trying to charge the thing really fast, and if you're doing it regularly, bit by bit, these little bits of metal start growing into the... And then, of course, what happens is you get a short circuit as the one side starts to get close to the other side, and that sets fire to the lithium. So if you want it, by the way, if you've got an electric vehicle or you do use lithium batteries, just never use the fast charge. And you can see on the motorways and the motorway service stations, Martin, hundreds of cars, maybe scores of cars, 30, 40 cars, sitting there. People are in the service area looking rather glum, whilst their cars are sitting there week after week, day after day, on fast charge.
Yeah, I understand from reading Warwick Powell, who's an Australian academic who knows about these things, that the Chinese are moving towards sodium-based batteries, which is a different...
Ooh, sodium catches fire quite well.
Well, I know, but I mean, the point is that they've seen the problem with lithium and they've already decided...
You ever set fire to sodium? We used to do that at school.
Well, I don't know the details. I'm just saying...
In fact, they kept the
if
sodium
If people are
away.
Interested in they this stuff, the they should read Warwick Powell's Substack.
I think we used to drip it. I remember we used to put it into water, drop it into the water. It explode, basically.
But the thing about it is also, I think it is lots cheaper than lithium. It's easier to find. Yeah.
Right, okay, well, everything's going over to sodium, which is even more explosive. Maybe they should just put high-explosive TNT in batteries and be done with it.
Well, maybe this
as soon as you plug it in, it goes
maybe
bang.
Maybe we should just have a nuclear war and stop arguing about electric cars.
Or else use diesel. Yeah, diesel. Oh, no, it's terrible stuff.
There's a bit of a problem with diesel.
Maybe a coal-powered car.
Yes. It's called a train.
A coal-powered railway system that works on that lovely South Wales call. So anyway, back, I think we were talking about Prime Minister's questions, and we've kind of strayed off the subject.
Yes.
Sorry, folks. So let's go back to that. Now, this is Starmer's last.
There's Savile Roberts.
Yeah.
Diolch yn fawr iawn, Lefarydd. The end of the Prime Minister's premiership comes close on the heels of the end of Labour's 100-year dominance in Wales. People simply didn't feel that his party stood up for them. And it's irrefutable that this too is part of the Prime Minister's legacy. There is a tradition, I believe, of leaving notes on desks for successors. So will he leave a useful note to the incoming Prime Minister that respect and understanding go a very long way, and that democratic choices, including those of devolution, can't be dismissed?
I shall leave a note saying what we delivered for Wales in these 2 years was the largest ever devolution settlement, the UK's first small nuclear reactor in Anglesey, investing £14 billion in Welsh Rail, a pay rise for 170,000 workers across Wales, and I'll end the note by saying we're lifting 70,000 Welsh children out of poverty. Nick Keir Starmer.
No problems guessing that AI gave in that reply. Very wooden, no wit and humour. Even, you know, Liz Savile Roberts there from Plaid Cymru's got a bit of a few witticisms, but he has none of it. He's not no spontaneous. It's just like, yeah, he is the AI. He's, I think, the first AI Prime Minister we've ever actually had. Rishi Sunak seemed to have a bit of personality, but this guy's got none.
Well, you won't have to worry about him too soon. He'll be history, so you don't have to worry about him.
We just have to worry
about Starmer's personal failings. It's neither here nor there, really, is it? He's out now.
Yeah.
To talk about
him. So what about Burnham, then?
What about him? He's got his opportunity to be Mr. Punch. Let's see what happens. And of course, he's trapped by the deep state. Like they all are.
Is he already trapped, do you think?
Yes, of course he is. The only thing he can do, as I've said earlier, is he's got to go big for PR. And that, of course, will pull Plaid Cymru in behind
him. Will he do that?
Probably not, Tony. Probably not. That's the problem.
So is there anything that you think that could convince him to start taking?
He's already said that he was in favour of PR, but he's now been got at and saying, well, we'll have a discussion about it. What he ought to do is just say, that's what we're going to do. We're going to change the way politics is done, because at the next election in this country, it will be a PR election, and that will change the game completely. Everybody have to move to different parts of the pitch, start talking in a different sort of way. It puts reform and restore on the back foot. Are you in favour of PR? Yes or no? Yes or no? Vote for this, you know, he could actually dominate the debate, but he won't, because what he's going to do is just try and be a different kind of Labour Prime Minister, and that's the lack of imagination that drives me nuts about this.
Mr. Speaker, he is the one who is resigning because of his MPs. There's no point trying to distract from it. And let's be honest, Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister has made many mistakes, otherwise he wouldn't be going. But he has also been let down. I'm only saying what his staff have been briefing. He has been let down by an energy secretary who is killing industry, let down by a chancellor who is killing jobs, let down by backbenchers who don't understand that government is about tough choices. He U-turned again and again and again to appease them, and now they've abandoned him. And what for? A pair of eyelashes and a black T-shirt. Isn't the truth that whoever is in charge, the real problem is the Labour Party?
Mr. Speaker, 2 years ago, I walked into Number 10 and found a broken economy, broken public services, and broken trust in politics. Because of our decisions, my decision, the country is moving in the right direction, a stronger and a fairer Britain, ending austerity, investing in our public services, the fastest fall in NHS waiting list for 17 years, more rights for workers, more rights for renters, standing with Ukraine, Britain's reputation restored, and 500,000 children being lifted out of poverty. Change promised by a Labour government, fought for by a Labour government, change delivered by a Labour government.
Yeah, so that's it. Almost certainly no more appearances from him at all. Do you think he'll ever be recycled like Ed Miliband was?
I think I understand from what I've read that he's not even going to ask for a cabinet place. He's just going to become a backbencher, which may mean that he's actually going to retire from politics at some point.
Will he become a good little constituency MP?
I've no idea. We'll just have to see. Don't forget, Andrew Feinstein nearly took his seat at the election.
What do you think he will be most? What actually brought him down finally, do you think?
I think it was the May election results, because it just became clear that with him there, for rightly or wrongly, I mean, lots of people like, you know, Fangham Debonair, you know, reason, but they all liked him, they thought he was okay. But if on the doorstep, she's just getting a load of, you know, he's useless.
He's a dud
and all of that. There's a certain amount, you can't actually turn that round. You know, if people, you know, you've had your go. And
Spin doctors are paid marvellous amounts of money, aren't they, to sit up there in Westminster and try and make someone who's rubbish and useless, it's look good.
Well, I mean,
try to put spin
people,
on this.
You need people who actually people. You know,
have someone who's convincing, and he was no longer convincing.
No, that's right. And of course, that's to do. You know, it's all very.
Yeah, I actually think Martin, the real nail in the coffin was this Mandelson business.
Yes, and of course Trump was picking up on that. And the real problem with Mandelson, he was too close to Epstein, which is what we should all be talking about.
Mandelson was actually responsible for the rise of Keir Starmer, and also that guy, what was his name, Owen Smith, who tried to channel Corbyn. So Mandelson is sort of still hovering around there in the background. He's been arrested, he's been released, there's pure evidence out there that it's quite obvious that he's broken the law, that he's been telling his mates secrets from the cabinet committees. It's there in the files, which is a crime punishable by up to life in prison. It's called misconduct in public office. But there's still no announcement or anything about Mandelson. Is he even in the country? I wonder if he's managed to sneak out of the country. There's nothing seems to be happening about Mr. Mandelson, does it?
And nobody's talking about Donald Trump's Epstein files, even though there was a specific instruction.
Just talking about Mandelson.
Mandelson is about Epstein. Why are we talking about Mandelson?
It's not, isn't it? Actually, no. Mandelson is about Israel.
Yes. That's right.
As Peter Ford pointed out.
That's right. It's all about Israel.
Starmer has put Mandelson into the ambassador job in Washington so that he can look at all of the secret traffic that's going backwards and forwards between America and Britain and hand it over to the Israelis.
That's right. And no doubt all the Labour Party's political enemies will be going about Mandelson, Kemi Badenoch and Nigel Farage, I'm looking at you. Will you condemn Israel's involvement in the Epstein affair? Yeah? Come on. Yes or no?
I think this has become almost like a litmus test for every single person in public life, this business of Israel and the genocide, hasn't it?
It has, but British politics have made up their mind that the Israelis are in the
right. It's not just the right wing. It's absolutely not just the right wing.
No, it's the right wing Labour Party
right
as well.
The right and left divide.
The real left are always opposed to Israel.
There's no real left.
Well, there is.
Where?
I'm sitting here right next to you,
Well,
Tony.
No, I mean in power, Martin, in power, anywhere close to power. This pro and anti-Israel thing, well, I mean, for example...
Sinn Féin look as if they're going to take...
You know
the lobby and
Shai Massot. It was Alan Duncan who they removed from power,
yeah.
Right? He wasn't a lefty, was he?
No, he was a centrist.
No, he was a government minister.
Yes.
And he was a right-wing conservative government minister.
No, he wasn't a right-wing conservative. He was a moderate conservative.
Alan Dung, if they can get rid of him, I think it's just really silly
they
to
say to be able
that
to
this
get...
is a left-right thing. It's
well,
not.
Well, it is a left-right thing, Tony. Of course it is.
Mamdani
has just had a load of Democrat primary wins in New York. And the Israel lobby are freaking out because all of these people are opposed to Israel. So
what does Biden make about it all?
Biden doesn't even know what day of the week it is or what country he's in.
The Democrats, what do they make of it all? They're generally pro-Palestinian.
The Democrats are not generally pro-Palestinian. The leadership definitely not, same as the Labour Party here. We do need to have this row.
I rest my case. Well, saying that if the left in the States and the Democrats in the States can't support Palestine, it's not a left-right divide.
Listen, Tony, name me one serious right-winger who opposes who supports Palestine.
Well, I don't
there isn't that. One. It is a left-right divide.
What
it's
about
a big
Tucker
one.
Carlson? He's left. He's right-wing.
He started to move. Yeah, that is interesting. That what you get from people who were originally on the right wing of U.S. politics are starting to wake up about Israel.
I don't know if you've
which
seen
is positive,
Sky. Sky this week interviewed Tucker Carlson about a bit about Trump, largely, and talking about the Iran war, etc. And it's quite entertaining. I should put a link to that full interview, actually, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. He was joking with, I think it was, it's Sophie Ridge on Sky News. I'm not sure what her name is, or Halder or something. I can't remember the woman's name. But he was saying, look, everyone's hypnotised. You're hypnotised. I'm hypnotised. And what, of course, he's talking about here is the power of the Western media.
Yes, well, I mean, the Western media is dominated by Zionist narrative mongers. Yeah, they work very hard to control both social media and mainstream media. So, you know, things become lots of different countries, for example, have all signed up to a statement saying that the tax on Jewish community centres in Australia and Belgium and Netherlands, it's all actually being orchestrated by an Iranian revolutionary cell. And you know which one it is, the one they made up. That is patently bad faith. There is not a shred of evidence to suggest that the Iranians are behind any of those things. And to say it shows that you are habitual liars.
Well, it's about time we had David Miller live on this programme, since he only lives a few streets away again. But anyway, for now, we'll have to make do with Tucker Carlson.
Every other media organization in the United States is saying one thing. They're for neoconservative foreign policy and neoliberal economic policy. And then there's Elon, who's like, well, he's got his views, but then he opens it up to other people's views. And some of those people are for neoconservative foreign policy and neoliberal economic policy, and some of them aren't. So, like, okay, yeah, it's not a defense of Elon to say, I'm glad that we have an alternative to CBS News and Fox News and CBS and NBC and CNN and MSNBC and the New York Times, the Washington Post, and, like, The Economist, and every other news organization in the world has one position, and Elon has a kind of buffet style setup where you can kind of pick and choose what you want.
Well, I mean, I guess the concern that many have is that when he says things like violence is coming for you at a massive rally of a far right activist Tommy Robinson.
And Tommy Robinson's not far right.
Well, I mean, you
Tommy
know,
Robinson is like some kind of agent of Israel whose main concern is that we like not criticize what's happening in Gaza. Tommy Robinson's a total fraud, like an utter fraud.
But at one of those
Tommy
rallies,
Robinson.
I mean, Elon Musk did say, you know,
it's not even his name. The whole thing is fake, dude. No, I don't care about Tommy Robinson, who's like literally like whatever the Nick Fuentes of Britain. It's like fake. It's made up. What I care about are ordinary Britons of all colors who see their country becoming something that they didn't sign up for, that they don't want, and they have no way to change the outcome. You had one labor leader who was the head of the Labor Party who disagreed on Israel, and the next thing you know, they like call him a Nazi, which he wasn't. He's kind of a buffoon or whatever, but like he was a different flavor. And they slandered him until he just went into obscurity. Same with George Galloway. You can agree or disagree with George Galloway, but he's like his own man. Everybody else is on the company program, left or right. And then you look at Reform, which I've sort of rooted for because I like Nigel a lot personally, and I've always followed British politics, and I've always wanted there to be an alternative. Once Boris turned out to be identical to any Labour person, you know, the whole thing is fake. With Boris, it was obvious it was fake. This is fake. So then you're like, okay, well, there's Reform and there's an option. They're fake too. It's so bonkers because they may have different views on trans or whatever, the fake issues that are designed purely to divide us. But on the questions of foreign policy and economics,
and what makes
pretty much the same.
But what makes a society? You know, what when people are living in a society, what are they looking for? Cohesion? You know, the measure of a society is life expectancy.
Right.
Infant mortality rates, crime rates, and on all of these fronts, I mean, Britain is doing better than most U.S. cities.
But much worse than it was 40 years ago on all four of those measures. Much worse.
But isn't
much
that, that's worse. Happening across the Western
100%. World. And as I said to you off camera, and I should just say it on camera, I spent a lot of time beating up on Britain, again, because I feel like I'm tied to it in some basic way, but also because I have these identical frustrations about the United States, and it's just easier to beat up on Britain.
So it's sort of projecting.
Yeah, it's totally
projecting.
I was telling you, and I just want to say this again on, for the record, I have family in London, and I'm always beating up on London because I've gone there my whole life, and it has definitely not gotten better. It's gotten worse. So I'm always like, Britain's out of control, London's out of control, Sadiq Khan, you know, whatever. And this relative, close relative, said to me, what U.S. city's better than London? And it's just true. London is nicer than any American city. It's just true. I don't want that to be true, but it is true. So I was really stung by that because it was just undeniable. So I'm going to suspend all criticism of Britain and just turn it on my own country because I actually live here and I really, really care about the United States and would say that the measures that you just listed, and you were right to put cohesion for societal cohesion, you know your neighbors, you have something in common with them, you care what happens to them. What's important in a family is important in a nation. Way down. Life expectancy, down. Infant mortality, up. Like, that's happening. And I just feel like those are the measures that matter. I mean, they're not the only measures that matter. But the public has no means by which they can arrest the slide, that they can slow the degradation. Clearly, no matter who they vote for, they get the same policies. That's not democracy. And I guess I'm just autistic or literal or something. I'm enraged when people call that a democracy. How is that a democracy? You get what we're serving tonight. There's no menu. Here's your slop. You like it or you don't like it, but you're not getting anything else. That's not a restaurant. That's prison.
Anyway, he's good. I love listening to Tucker Carlson. I think he's one of those people that wears his heart on his sleeve. And it's nice to hear him talking about, well, we were talking about this before we started, but it's a good idea to talk about it now. I think he's a real pro, and I trust that he's genuinely, apparently he's quite close to Donald Trump, Martin, and he's been telling Trump that he's made a massive mistake with this Iran war again and again. It may have actually got through, you never know. Trump, if you remember Gary O'Donoghue, I think it was, might even have been tail end of last year. Oh, it's a while ago, anyway, 6, 8 months, 9 months ago, was saying how when he interviewed Donald Trump, he did an audio interview with Donald Trump, and he said, well, do you trust Vladimir Putin? And Trump said, well, I don't really think I trust anyone. And in that moment, you can see the sort of situation someone like Trump is in. And I'm no fan of his, but I have sympathy in the same way as I do with Andy Burnham, that these people are public figures, but actually they're surrounded by weasels.
Well, they may be weasels themselves. I mean, you weren't cutting Keir Starmer much slack earlier, so it's not a general thing, is it? I mean, Tucker Carlson is a right-wing American, and the fact that he's now got some views which are similar to mine, that's good. It's useful. But he's on a different planet.
He's a good journalist. I don't care. He's a good journalist, and he's done a. He did a very good job.
Self-publicity is very important by a journalist, isn't it?
You're just making out he's some egotist, which he's not. If you look at his work that he did on Fox, it was clear that he was very good for audiences. He was bringing loads of people in to Fox. I cannot remember the name of the company, but it was a voting machine. Company that he did a report on, saying that these electronic voting machines are not safe. They then came for him and forced Murdoch's hand to get rid of him. But before all that, of course, he was doing some very good work on COVID and looking at the dangers of the COVID vaccines particularly, but also on the origin, the implications of with Steve Hilton. He was doing stuff on the EcoHealth Alliance and Peter Daszak and the other people involved in this gain of function research. So I was amazed at the time. I was thinking, crikey, this is good television, amazing television. And so I don't think he's doing it for his ego particularly. He comes from a wealthy family,
yeah,
good,
as they all
good
do.
Good luck to him. Yeah. Anyone who's successful in life, I wish them good wealth and good health.
He started off with a bit of money. He didn't just wake his way up from the ground floor.
We're not really trying to destroy his personality.
No, all right.
What we're trying to do is look at whether he's a good journalist or not.
Well, I mean, what was interesting to me is he did a 5-part series on 9/11. Nothing in there that we wouldn't have known about for years. But, of course, he's got a much massiver audience than we've got. And these are conservative Americans, yeah?
Why doesn't the BBC show loose change? That would make a good...
The BBC cannot show loose change.
Why not?
Because it would breach the guidelines of impartiality and all the rest of it. The deep state.
Tony, why?
Because they can't do it. You know why? It's a state-run broadcaster.
Well, it's run
by
Google.
They could make their own TV series about it with their own journalists investigating 9/11.
What they do is they pay. What was the guy that made it? I can't remember his name, but they just pay him, give him whatever it is, 25, 30 grand. Is it okay if we show this? And they could even put it on iPlayer, pay him another 10 grand.
Yes, all right, but they're not going to do that because then loads of other people will be screaming and shouting.
Because he'll make another film. And it'll be really interesting. It'll be about the Iran war.
That's right. So in other words, why are we sitting here unpaid having a sort of discussion about all of this? Because in actual fact, it's impossible to work in the mainstream and get this stuff out there. People sometimes do. Tucker Carlson, insofar as he has done it, I'm pleased. Because, of course, it's much more useful for people like him to start pointing the finger at Israel than it is for people like us.
I've always been an enemy of Israel.
But he, when he's, a lot of Americans are suddenly realising what they're like.
Yeah, well, say someone like Ken O'Keefe. Is he right-wing?
Well, I don't even know who we're talking about.
I think he was an ex-Marine, US guy. Anyway, let's have a listen to him.
I support the right of self-defence without any doubt. I would be involved myself in violent resistance if I were a citizen of Palestine or Iraq or Afghanistan. And if I were a citizen of the United States or Britain and someone from halfway around the world came into my country and started stealing my land and killing my family, guess what? I would defend my country as well. So I absolutely 100% defend the right of self-defense, and I will never shy away from that. I will not join the long list of embarrassments who condemn terrorism while forgetting to acknowledge that the biggest terrorist on the planet is the United States government.
Hamas doesn't recognize the right of Israel to exist.
You know what that sounds like to me? That sounds like the African National Congress and Nelson Mandela refusing to accept apartheid and recognize apartheid. I say that Israel, if it wants to be a genuine partner in any kind of peace, needs to destroy its whole ideology of Zionism. Zionism that makes other people goyim, who do not deserve to be in the Holy Land. That's the real problem. If Israel will embrace every people, including Palestinians, equally, human rights respected across the board, then I would challenge Hamas to change its charter and say, we will acknowledge Israel. But until that time, I see no difference between Nelson Mandela and Hamas in refusing to accept apartheid or the Zionist Israeli state.
Well, I mean, Ken O'Keefe is an ex-Marine, but obviously his views are to the left these days, I would say.
Gulf War veteran.
Yeah. But, of course, he also said if I was in Afghanistan, I would have fought back against the invasion. Yep, fair enough. Most people will. That's the problem with going to other people's countries, isn't it?
It's interesting, isn't it? He's saying the Israelis don't have the right to self-defence. And he's saying that everybody has the right to self-defence. And actually, of course, the Israelis do not have the right to self-defence in occupied Palestine.
No, they don't. That's right.
And the occupation of Palestine, officially, legally, is the 1967 borders as spelled out in Resolution 242.
Yes, I know, but I mean, in actual fact, their official borders should be the 1948 borders, and since they don't accept those, we might say that you're not to be there at all.
You might say that.
We need a one-state solution.
Though that was surpassed in 1967 with this UN Resolution 242, it solidified what the borders were. And of course, they've been pushing and pushing ever since.
It didn't really, because they already captured the Golan Heights and all the rest of it in 73.
They said they've got to give them back.
No. So in other words, in actual fact, well, I think we've reached the point, but Russian and Chinese position is still this, that there's got to be a two-state solution. But I think in the rest of the world, it's increasingly becoming clear there isn't going to be a two-state solution. There's going to be a one-state solution. It's going to be called Palestine. Lots of Jewish people won't want to live in it, and they'll just have to go somewhere else like people do. There's going to be loads of refugees in World War III. We've already got more refugees on the move now than any time since World War II. And that's not going to stop anytime soon.
No, I think the other thing that has stopped is Tulsi Gabbard as the Director of National Intelligence. What do you think has persuaded her to resign?
I think she was forced out.
Well, yeah, but she officially resigned.
Well, she doesn't support the war on Iran. You know, basically, she's there, supposedly. She was window dressing for Trump to show that he was taking account of anti-war views. And, of course, when it came down to it, she had no influence at all.
She has had influence of some sort. I'm quite certain about that. And also, of course, within the profession. So she had a purge of a whole load of people who had been causing trouble previously within the National Security Agency. So if nothing else has been achieved, that's been achieved by Tulsi Gabbard. But on her way out, she had a couple of interesting things to say about COVID and Dr. Fauci.
Dr. Fauci's close relationships with the intelligence community enabled him to assume three key roles that shield him from scrutiny. First, Dr. Fauci funded dangerous gain-of-function coronavirus research linked to Big Pharma and their pursuit of universal vaccines worth trillions of dollars. Second, Dr. Fauci was the behind-the-scenes advisor who, alongside his hand-picked so-called experts, pushed the intelligence community to endorse a natural animal origin to hide his dangerous gain-of-function research that he funded using taxpayer dollars, all of this in a deliberate attempt to cover up the truth and shift the blame and attention away from Fauci's own actions. Third, Dr. Fauci became the nation's pandemic pundit, and he publicly pushed lies, disinformation, and censorship using every platform available. Now, according to hundreds of reviewed emails, which are included in this release, the intelligence community almost always incorporated Fauci's recommendations. He promoted a fraudulent paper whose publication he helped prompt as legitimate information for intelligence community consideration. Senior analysts praised Dr. Fauci not as a policymaker, but as what they called an unbiased guide to the real coronavirus experts, while deliberately ignoring experts who might dissent from Fauci's narratives. Now, Fauci didn't stop there. He blatantly lied to Congress under oath during his 2024 testimony to the House Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Pandemic, denying that he ever spoke to any intelligence agency about COVID. Now, the correspondence I'm releasing today directly contradicts his sworn testimony. Now, we received statements from multiple whistleblowers revealing that the intelligence analysts who dared to challenge Dr. Fauci's COVID origin conclusions faced threats of retaliation, marginalization, and many suffered career setbacks. For example, a contractor was terminated just days after coming forward to ODNI as a whistleblower. Another example, those who advocated for the lab leak hypothesis or expressed dissenting views were reminded by their managers that leadership would determine which analysts would be promoted and which would not. The message was clear: go along or be punished. Senior leaders also sought to undermine whistleblowers by removing anonymity, which is required in the whistleblower process, as they made their complaints, and also insisting that their managers or attorneys be present during ODNI meetings where these whistleblowers were coming forward with their testimony, obviously creating an atmosphere of intimidation. The COVID pandemic caused tremendous hardship and pain for millions of our fellow Americans and countless people around the world. Now, after years of lies and censorship and cover-ups, the American people deserve transparency, truth, and accountability. The tactics that were used to hide the truth are straight from the deep state playbook. Politicized self-serving leaders like Dr. Fauci covered up their own wrongdoing and abuses of power, manipulated intelligence, lied to Congress, and undermined a duly elected president by restricting his access to the vital facts he needed to keep the country safe. It's time you know the truth.
Well, that's actually only the first of a couple of things we're going to hear from Tulsi Gabbard. Martin, I think you were right about her. Probably about 7 or 8 years ago, you were saying you want to watch this one. She's good.
Yeah, well, of course, she went into the Trump administration because she was a Democrat originally. And of course,
I think you'll find she is a Democrat.
Well, no. Well, I mean, Democrat with a small D or Republican with a small R.
She has Democrat leanings, you know.
Yeah, well, she was a Democrat congresswoman at one stage, yeah. But, of course, she was always very, very circumspect about saying anything about Israel. So, therefore, she wasn't, you know, if you're going to go anywhere in the political system in the U.S., you've got to decide, you know, what you're going to...
be agnostic on Israel in order to succeed and do good stuff in politics, that's okay.
Well, it's a necessary thing if you're going to do what she's done.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's just leave it at that. Yeah, if you don't do that,
it seems to me the stuff that she's found out as Director of National Intelligence is she's found this stuff out. She's probably said, "Look, I want to make this public." She's been told, "Well, you can't really do that," but she's done it outside that system.
Yes,
she's decided, "Look, this I've done my little stint in there, a couple of years, and now you know I've had enough."
So, well, I mean, I welcome what she's done.
Maybe she'll come back in into politics.
She may decide to have a political career separate from the what she's done.
I hope she does.
Who knows? But I mean, the other thing that she's pointed out, and I'm sure you're going to have a clip on it now, is about the biolabs in the Ukraine.
After months of searching through intelligence community holdings and files, today I'm releasing new evidence of long-standing U.S. government funding of more than 120 biolabs in over 30 countries. Now, these biolabs include labs in places like Ukraine, which could be at risk of compromise due to the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war. In fact, the intelligence community had previously warned that a U.S.-funded biolab in Ukraine likely housed dangerous pathogens and remained vulnerable to long-standing threats of Russian attack, seizure, or damage. Now, until now, evidence regarding the full existence and funding of these laboratories had been knowingly withheld from you, the American people. Many of these U.S. government-funded biolabs are currently or have previously engaged in research using hazardous and highly contagious pathogens, and in some cases included dangerous gain-of-function research, with very little visibility or oversight. Now, President Trump clearly understands the serious threat dangerous gain-of-function research poses to the American people. And this is why he took decisive action over a year ago. On May 25th, 2025, he signed an executive order to end federal funding of gain-of-function research around the world. Here at ODNI, I issued new guidance to the intelligence community directing increased collection on these laboratories and facilities overseas. And we're already seeing the results of this increased collection. We're learning new details, for example, on clinical trials that are underway at these facilities and that are raising significant ethical, financial, and security concerns regarding the supposed public health initiatives and U.S. national security. Now, despite the obvious potential for catastrophic global impact that research on dangerous pathogens in biolabs can have, politicians and so-called health professionals like Dr. Fauci, as well as entities within the Biden administration's national security team, lied repeatedly to the American people about the existence of U.S.-funded and supported biolabs. Not only did they lie, they threatened those who attempted to expose the truth. So this release today breaks new ground, as the information surrounding the existence, history, locations, and funding of these U.S.-funded biolabs has been intentionally covered up by very powerful people who falsely claimed that these biolabs didn't exist. Now, they accuse anyone who says otherwise to be foreign assets and traitors to America. Now, Odie and I will continue working closely with partners across the U.S. government to identify exactly where these labs are and what pathogens they contain to end dangerous gain-of-function research that threatens the health and well-being of the American people and people around the world.
So ODNI is her office, Office of Director of National Intelligence, only she's now resigned. But, I mean, this is pretty explosive stuff she's talking about here. And she's also saying, well, as soon as she arrived, she asked for more and more information to be collected about what was going on in these labs. And it seems to me that those labs should have never been opened in the first place. What they're doing is something extremely dangerous and unsupervised in foreign countries, which is to basically weaponize various viruses and bacteria and whatever to make them deadly.
Yes, and of course it's all against conventions which they've signed up to, and the Russians and the Chinese have signed up to, not to do any of these things.
So well done, Tulsi, for revealing.
Well, that's good.
Things.
I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, of course, Jeffrey Sachs has got a bit of...
They got no coverage, that resignation information, did it?
I wonder why that is.
Isn't it funny? The Western press is not interested in what the actual origin of COVID was, and how the top intelligence officer in the entire United States is talking about it, but it's not appearing on our news media. Wonder why?
Well, you know the reason why, Tony.
It's because they're all complicit and they're evil, some sort of cult.
Well, that's right. I mean, and of course the Russians are very well aware of this. Kirillov, who's their general, who's the expert on all of this, the equivalent of Fauci, if you like, but he was assassinated by the SBU, but probably with the help of the British. And of course, if the idea of killing him
was to stop the investigation into this, it's not worked.
No, it hasn't.
Because Tulsi Gabbard is now talking about it all on the opposite side.
Yes, I know, and the point is that we're not hearing this in our media, but you'd be quite sure places like Iran and China and Russia, they know all this already.
Well, they would also be hearing little bits and pieces of time. She was accused of working for Putin by doing all this stuff.
Well, I mean, the point is that the underlying all of this, it looks to me, is what she's suggesting there, they shouldn't be doing this, is basically weapons research. It's not medical research at all. It's weapons research. It's not medical research.
And it's a weapon which can very easily blow back right in your face, mate, and kill you.
That's right, that's right. But also, of course, it was deliberately released, in my view. That's what the Iranian Salami, who was Soleimani's successor, said as soon as it broke out in Iran, because they'd carried out their own investigations.
Well, I think we said it too, you know.
Well, I think the people like us first said it.
First show of February 2020, we were saying exactly that, because there was a report from the... Institute of Virology at New Delhi University, which said, look, they pulled apart the genome, which had just been released by the Chinese. They had a day-long brainstorming session within New Delhi University, and they said that it would be very strange, or this doesn't look as if it could possibly happen naturally.
Well, the other killer fact, of course, is that the Israeli Defense Forces told the Israeli media, including the Times of Israel and the television, that they got a heads up from the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States that a pandemic was coming out of China 2 months before it came out. Now, that implies foreknowledge, so we don't even have to discuss anything. If you've got foreknowledge, you are definitely a suspect, aren't you? because you just are. Even Dixon or Doc Green can work that one out. Inspector Cluedo.
I think it was when we were hearing from Tucker Carlson, he was saying lots of sort of positive things about Elon Musk. I think he's one of those, like David Miller, has a bit too much faith in Musk. Because this week, on Sunday evening, I tweeted out, I mean, my Twitter account is, I mean, I get all these lovely messages. Thank you to everyone that does that, who are followers of mine on Twitter. And they send me a little thing back saying, look at this, Tony, I'm trying to read your tweet and I've got this danger message, and it's just something totally innocuous, you know. So it's like you have to jump through various of Musk's hoops to even read what I've said on this tweet. So they're definitely, you know, he's definitely suppressing me for whatever reason, maybe because I know he's game, you know. But anyway, on Sunday evening, I noticed around about tea time that there was some news coming out. I was just sort of half looking at what was going on, that Trump had said that Starmer was going to resign as a prime minister, and he's failed badly. So that was said on Sunday, the 21st of June, 2026, this last Sunday just gone, at 31 minutes past 6 BST. And I just checked that out because I checked the what I could find is the earliest article, which was from the Independent newspaper online. And then lo and behold, at 10 p.m. on Sunday, there was just like 3 minutes before 10 o'clock on Sunday, it was announced Starmer is expected to announce his departure on Monday. So I'm thinking to myself, this is being announced in the United States before it's being announced to Brits. So the whole world knows before Downing Street says anything or before anyone. I mean, we all know that there was no way that Starmer could carry on. He was still pretending he could and not fooling very many people. So I put this tweet out, just a picture of the Starmer scratching his head, looking sort of blandly confident, and with the timings of these two news stories, so that's 3.5 hours apart. So announced in the United States in Washington, and 3.5 hours announced in London. So, and on that tweet, I said Starmer announces resignation 3.5 hours after Trump says he will. And anyway, at that point, my Twitter account was instantly suspended. I didn't actually notice because I just tweeted, and then the next day I realised, oh, they've suspended my account. That's when it was. And so this only ever got one retweet, and that was from me, although it had 61 views. So my entire Twitter account was suspended because I'd noticed that that there'd been a 3.5 hour gap between the Americans announcing Starmer's resignation and London. And of course, this says volumes about who's, you know, where is this little pipsqueak country and the Americans are in charge. But what for me was almost more surprising was that 3 days later, I think it was Wednesday, maybe Thursday, that my account was just reinstated because I deliberately did not appeal it. So I was thinking to myself, well, just leave it and see what happens. And so the account all suddenly turned up again. So several people have asked me. I put this stuff up immediately on to my social media account on Facebook, and there's lots of people responded on there, you know, with screenshots of the suspension, etc. And the consensus seems to be, Martin, that the idea is that the AI is watching out on Twitter for anything that might be go viral, and then it kills it and makes sure it can't happen until after the news story is passed.
Yes, it's narrative control. And I don't suppose Elon Musk sits there doing it in person. That's what the AI bots are for. They just program them to do, you know, if there's anything that looks as if it might start causing trouble, let's squash it before it gets going.
As a news story rolls out and is presented to the public as a fait accompli, like Starmer's off, you know, there is maybe contingencies taking place at the same time to say to all the news organisations to monitor them, to make sure that they don't point out this is an American decision.
Well, I don't think it's an American decision.
Well, I do.
What I think is quite likely.
I didn't say that, but it is. I mean, it seems to me is the Americans have said it's time to go, and so London goes okay then. The journalists, obviously, after Trump's, whatever, it's not a tweet, is it, on Truth Social, would have been calling Downing Street and saying, okay, well, Trump said he's going. What do you say? Oh, we don't say anything. We don't say anything. 3.5 hours later, we say, okay, yes, he's off.
More likely, they just actually bug all the phones in Downing Street. That's much more likely. So, of course, they know. And then somebody tells Trump. That's what went on there.
So does Britain tell the Americans what to do?
No, they just bug our phones so they know what we're doing, and then they can take steps before we know what's going on.
No, it's certainly a possibility. So there was also some more, I thought, you know, press manipulation this week. That's over the hot weather. Have you been enjoying yourself? Are you getting too hot?
Well,
Martin,
I would enjoy hot weather. I'm that sort of person, but it's been too hot for me in the sense that I've just not gone out and stayed indoors, which I don't normally do, but it was just easier to do that.
So my Twitter thing was in authenticity, apparently. I did something which was unauthentic, allegedly. So do you think this is evidence of climate change? And
I'm not going to get bogged down in discussing that because I think it's a big issue. And I'm actually agnostic about it. I'm willing to listen to arguments about either way. The stuff I know about economics, politics, intelligence services, I'm prepared to be fairly, you know, this is what I think. Climate change, I'm open to debate about it.
Well, okay, so it's in the Press Gazette this week, which is always worth a look. It's got all sorts of interesting things about what's going on in journalism. Charlotte Tobit did this story. She says that climate scientists have said news coverage is ignoring the cause of the UK heatwave. Connection between greenhouse emissions and extreme heat in the UK is indisputable. So a group of leading climate scientists have written to broadcast editors across the UK and London to express concerns about recent heatwave coverage. The letter urged news organisations so that you must better inform the public of the scientific links between extreme weather, climate change and net zero. It argued that news coverage increasingly overlooks the fundamental why. So they're also, you see, this is a bit where they get very cheeky. They're saying not only is it to do with climate change, but net zero is the solution.
Well, everybody's pushing their agenda all the time, aren't they? That's what happens. Those who are concerned about, just think, if you're a scientist and you really are concerned about climate change, you know, they're genuine people. They may be wrong, but of course they are, you know, they're getting hot under the collar and saying, well, why can't people face up to the obvious that this is climate change?
Well, you could also say
I'm a bit skeptical, but there you are. They're going to say that, aren't they?
They're just jumping on this little bandwagon. You're saying, well, actually, even though it's a heat wave, this proves that net zero is right.
Well, of course, in other words, people are pushing their various agendas. Mm. That's what they're doing.
They're supposed to be scientists, Martin. They're just a group of scientists. They're just a group of scientists. Science cannot be biased in the way you suggest.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying that everybody is involved in
only
pushing their agenda.
It can, because all these scientists these days are generally paid in one way or another.
No doubt these scientists are paid by the climate change industry, if you want to call it
the
that.
The net zero industry.
Yeah. Okay, so that's where they get their research funding from and all the rest of it.
King Charles.
Okay, but then other scientists who disagree, who are paid by the oil industry, were saying that's a load of rubbish.
They're being paid by the king. The king's doing quite well. He's quite been shown to be quite wealthy this week.
£20,000. For Princess Anne's trip to the rugby, £126,000 travelling to Italy, and £66,000 sending staff on a recce to the US and Bermuda. The royal finances are out, so what do the numbers tell us, and more importantly, what don't they reveal? We now know for 2024-25, the King paid £12.9 million in tax. And Prince William, who'd previously decided not to divulge his tax bill, paid £7.76 million. It's the first time we've been given these figures. And remember, unlike me and you, neither has to pay tax. This is voluntary. These are big numbers. Last year, the total spending by the royal household was £132.1 million, of which £60 million went on the restoration of Buckingham Palace. The total working royal travel bill was £3.3 million, including £130,000 for Prince William's visit to Saudi Arabia, and over £48,000 on one trip to Lancashire for the King on the soon-to-be decommissioned royal train. Between them, the King and Queen carried out 708 public engagements last year. And they've now decided they won't ever move to Buckingham Palace. So is all this value for money? We asked forensic accountant Professor Atul Shah to look at the royal books.
There is transparency, but also there is there's quite a lot which is secret, which we don't know about.
So when you say things are secret, what is hidden in here then?
Well, we definitely don't have a clue about the overall big picture of the king's and the royal family's wealth. There is a hint that there is a large and material investment portfolio which the king holds, or the royal family owns.
So you think there's a lot we don't know about how much the king
is worth? Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm welcoming the transparency that the king is trying to give and the royal family. I have huge respect for the public leadership that King Charles is giving to the nation, but he could go further, and through by going further, he could develop much better trust from society and much better respect.
Yeah, so not very good trust, not very good respect at the moment. This is nice to see, a bit of admission of voluntary tax paying, but then actually, if you just say, well, you can pay tax if you want to, is he trying to normalise the situation?
Well, I mean, it's like getting blood out of a stone to get this information, isn't it? I mean, ultimately, the personal wealth of the monarchy, or, you know, if we were to become a republic, shouldn't that money be our money?
Well, the profit from the Crown Estate was over $1 billion for the third year running. He's only paying 24 million tax. Now, you know, that's out of 1,000 billion. I mean, 1,000 million. I mean, so this is peanuts, actually.
Yes. And, of course, ultimately, the question is, does that land belong to him or does it belong to everybody?
I think the other item here, well, good question.
In Ireland, it doesn't belong to him anymore. It belongs to the Irish people. Good. There was a bit of a struggle about
that.
As
it should be here. But the interesting thing he was talking about there was this big investment portfolio. We know nothing about how big it is or where it's invested. Is it invested in the same sort of things that he's pushing and lobbying for?
Well, most likely it is.
Like Putin, a war against Putin. He doesn't like Putin. He thinks Putin's got to go.
Well, yes, and that's for my mind is a, you know, another brick in the wall. People just are absolutely stupid about this. What we're going to we're like a dog that likes chasing buses. We're going to get our war with Russia, and then we're going to regret that we tried to bite the bus because we're going to get run over.
It estimated his personal wealth at $1.8 billion. Buckingham Palace said the figure is a highly creative mix of speculation, assumption, and inaccuracy. And that's because they refused to tell anybody anything much about the royal finances. To me, in a way, I think, Martin, this is the sort of the gift that keeps on giving. The royal finances are in such a as the people are suffering with poverty, child poverty, with destruction of public services, things like elderly care just not happening for many people, the massive opulent wealth of the king and his failure to be honest about it is not going to go away as a problem. It's going to be the fingers going to be pointed at him increasingly more. Maybe he'll have to go.
Well, in Makerfield, there's which is in Wigan metropolitan area, they've got a dump which was full of toxic waste. It was actually owned by the Crown Estates or by the Duchy of Lancaster, and they wanted the local authority to pay to clean up the waste that they owned. So it was actually a factor in the Makerfield by-election.
Correct. And what the royals had done, they'd done everything they possibly could to cover it up, but they'd been trying to persuade the local authority to buy the land at a market value, even though the land was contaminated. So they're just, I think they have this sort of idea that, well, because we're royals, no one needs to know. It was almost like, this is national security, go away. And they use that as an excuse to fleece us all.
Presumably the people who are managing the stuff, they just want to maximise the return. But of course, in actual fact, there's a big question mark.
He's got to make
why
his
should
mind
local
up.
Taxpayers pick up this toxic waste that you he's belongs
gotta,
to you?
He's
you know?
Got to make. He's got to. Well, if someone else put it there, to be fair, but he's got to make his mind up. Is he a private king or is he a public king? That's not an easy decision to make. But he can't have it both ways.
Well, I would say that in actual fact, that's always been the issue going back into the Middle Ages. Okay, and that's why you get. But some countries don't have kings at all. Yeah, they just got rid of them.
We've been sitting on the fence for far too long.
Why let him upset us? Caiaphas, let him be. All those imbeciles we'll see. It really doesn't matter.
Jesus is important. We've let him go his way before. And while he starts a major war, we theorize and chatter.
He's just another scripture-thumping hack from Galilee.
The difference is they call him king. The difference frightens me. What about the Romans? When they see King Jesus crowned, do you think they'll stand around cheering and applauding? What about our people? If they see we've lost our nerve, don't you think that they deserve something more rewarding?
They've got what they want. They think so, anyway. If he's what they want, why take their toy away? He's a craze.
Put yourself in my place. I can hardly step aside. Cannot let my hands be tied. I am law and order. What about our priesthood? Don't you see that we could fall? If we are to last at all, we cannot be divided.
Then say so to the council, but don't rely on subtlety. Frighten them or they won't see.
Then we are decided.
Then we are decided.
Okay. dancing, dancing, dancing.
Loving awareness, Radio Caroline. Love and good music, Radio Caroline.
going to do so well. The With It Guys featuring Shirley Lewis and Feel All Right.
That's one of the Kiss pirate radio London DJs introducing that back in the days. Probably you probably find that radio Nick Gratwick supplied the transmitter and installed it in the top of some tower block in the early 1990s for Kiss, who then went on to get a nice license. You know, so this is that. Okay, so that's Shirley Lewis, as you just heard, with the With It Boys and the With It Guys, and it's called Carried Away from 1991. Worth saying something, I suppose, about this pirate radio scene in London that Nick Gratwick was involved in, because I got to know him very well. He was the guy that was installing most of the pirate radio transmitters around London, and he turned out to be a paedophile that was then recruited by the police to go and spy on loads of animal rights charities at the Newbury Bypass protest as well, anti-roads protest, which I was first met him. And it's quite shocking to discover that someone that you've known for a long time and thought of is that way inclined. But the question is, and we really ought to do some proper investigation into this sometime, why did the police decide not to let him carry on as an informer? So we will have a look into that one day, and it could have something to do with the very strange death of his business partner at Broadcast Warehouse, Roger Howe. So yeah, watch out for a little bit more intrigue in that one in future weeks. Why did the Met decide that their nice little informer, who was busy in putting radio transmitters on frigates from the Royal Navy to broadcast into Libya as part of the regime change operation, why was he outed as a paedophile? He even said to me that he was infiltrating paedophile gangs for the police. Was that true? Maybe not. No, I think it most probably wasn't true. But anyway, that goes with that very tangentially there, because of the fact that you've got a pirate radio announcer on the end of there from an old tape of mine. Before that, we had Martha and the Muffins, Echo Beach. I think that must have been around about 1980. Before that, of course, you know the name of the... You probably danced to that, Martin. Disco Inferno at some point, did you, over the years? Heatwave from 1976. And at the very beginning of that, it was called From Jesus Christ Superstar, which was 1973. We heard We Are Decided, and there's all sorts of great little tunes in that. So, welcome back to the Bristol Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We'll dive straight in with Russia, because I'm looking at Russia this week and Ukraine as an escalating situation. Am I right?
I think so. It's not very good, but most people are really blind to what's happening, I'm afraid.
Why?
Well, because they've been given 4 years of absolutely over-the-top propaganda. I mean, most people in this country are completely unaware of the massacre at Starobelsk the other week. Yeah, I saw a letter in The Guardian from somebody saying that the Ukrainians, although they supported them, some academic guy supported Ukraine, they were defending themselves against the evil Russians, but they shouldn't be attacking civilian targets in Russia. And he was talking specifically about oil refineries around Moscow, because that just undermines your case. And this person clearly was totally unaware that 20-odd teenage girls had been killed 2 weeks ago deliberately by the Ukrainians.
So this is not even in The Guardian itself, it's just a letter, and it's a missing letter from there as well.
Yes, it was a letter. I looked at it, because most of the letters are very much, you know, I thought, oh, this is somebody criticising Ukraine, what are they going to say? And they were criticising them for attacking, you know, they're saying, of course I support Ukraine, like all decent people do, on the other hand, they shouldn't really just...
I'm a fascist too, yeah. I've been programmed to be a fascist.
I know, but I mean, what was obvious reading the letter is that person had no idea at all about the massacre, which has obviously played really big in Russia. You can imagine, if 22 teenage girls were killed by a Russian missile strike in Britain, you wouldn't have heard the end of it.
Well, they haven't heard the end of it in Russia. Yeah. They've got elections coming up in September. Everybody's banging the fist in the on the table well, saying, the most do something about this.
Treacherous,
we know nothing about
the
it.
The most weaselly treacherous types in this build-up to what could potentially be a nuclear war between NATO and Russia are the London press. And yesterday, Channel 4 News decided to go big. This is what makes me suspicious, is when they start getting doing long so-called in-depth analysis pieces on how evil the Russians are, when actually the real evil side of this are those that have been funding Zelensky and the pro-Nazis in Ukraine. So let's have a listen now to this. There's Matt Fry on Channel 4 News yesterday interviewing a Ukrainian woman to begin with, and she goes on. We'll hear hopefully from some other clips of Matt Fry from Channel 4 News discussing this all, impartially of course, with a guy called Mark Urban, who used to be on the BBC.
So if it's a choice between escalation, whatever form that may take militarily, and suing for peace, it's escalation as far as you're concerned.
From me, for what it, the way it has gone, Putin had many times to stop, and he could have been an absolute victor of that war. He could have argued victory, and he hasn't. So I don't see how at this point, because that would mean once again that the group A, the group B, group C, like, okay, he is now weak and we actually can bite him, can take care of it. So he would go until, from my point of view, until the very end. On the other hand, before, he was not without rational thinking. So maybe there is still a moment when the KGB major, as he is, still has some president remained in him. The president he was for 20 years before 2020, 2022. And that decision may be made. But I personally think that Putin already has crossed that line, and he's the Putin of absolute victory or death.
Wow. Well, on that extraordinary note, it's time to say thank you and goodbye. Nina Khrushcheva.
Thank you, Nina.
Thank you very much. That was really interesting.
Yeah, so there she is. She's saying now is the time for escalation.
Well, she's a Ukrainian propagandist. That's what she is. And there you are. Zelensky has not stood for election. It's 2 years now since there's supposed to be an election. He hasn't stood because they don't dare to have one.
And but she's saying Putin doesn't want a deal. He doesn't want peace. Well, before the war even started, he was trying to get the West to sign this security agreement.
They've signed two agreements. There's Minsk 1, Minsk 2, and Istanbul.
He's already said, so long as the Russian-speaking regions are protected, then they can have peace. Yes. They keep going on about Crimea. Crimea is very much, almost 100% Russian-speaking, and so they all obviously want to stay with Russia. They don't want to go with Ukraine.
Well, they were only put into the Ukraine in 1954 on a whim. Yeah, so there was no particular reason for them being in the Ukraine at all. But so of course, when the Soviet Union collapsed, they suddenly find themselves an independent state. It's like, hang on a minute.
So let's pick up the conversation just after he finishes chatting with this Ukrainian lady there. And what does Matt Fry and Mark Urban, two of the greatest journalists supposedly in the UK, make of this conflict?
Thank you.
Well, Mark,
let's go.
What a note to end on. You know,
well,
but very clear from her.
Yeah,
very clear. And I would have, I mean, I don't know. I mean, do you see the same way? I mean, or is there some grey fuzziness there?
I think what I see is, for a whole host of reasons, and they come together on the financial, but exactly the connection you made with the loss of soldiers, the larger that figure gets. And, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we had the head of GCHQ saying it was over 500,000 dead. But anyway, big financial implications. The increasing effectiveness of the deep strike drone offensive by the Ukrainians, also by destroying all those oil storage depots and all those other bits of national infrastructure, also financial implications, as well as harming the prestige of Russia, that Petersburg and Moscow can be hit in this very public way. And then, of course, the lowering of the oil price and the problems with the state budget. So all those things come together. Now, does he, as Nina was suggesting, escape the jam he's in by either declaring some sort of martial law, finally abandoning the pretense that it's a special military operation, saying we have to mobilize the whole of Russian
society.
Which
may not work. I mean, you know, the reason why he hasn't done that yet is because he thought he could get away with it cheaply, because he's thinking like a KGB officer. You know, it's not full-scale war, it's surreptitious. Yeah, it's done through the back door. And I just want, I mean, but the thing that...
And there was a special mobilization a few months into the war.
There was.
Well, the first autumn of the war.
300,000.
Which I think caused a lot of bad feedback, I think.
But it was also in the outer provinces, wasn't it? So I remember in Dagestan they were upset because and suddenly people started heading for the border because young men up to a certain age thought they were going to be called up. But I also wonder, and this is something that, you know, she referred to there, the mystical side of Putin's brain, the mystical nature of this war. And the thing that always struck me when I was in Ukraine as the war was breaking out was, you know, this, all this religious stuff. And there he was, you know, being filmed praying by himself in his own little socially distant chapel. Do you remember it was just after COVID? And of course he spent COVID and lockdown rummaging through the archives of the Kremlin, then writing this extraordinary 6,000 word thesis on the Ruski Mir, the Russian world, and the importance of Kyiv and Ukraine to it. And so part of me thinks that for him, this is still, you know, Kyiv is the Temple Mount. This is where he has to get back to. So he's not, you know, lost sight of the kind of bigger mystical historical prize for him. On the other hand, he also understands numbers. You know, he's got a, or used to have a functioning brain. He's an intelligence guy in the sense that he must be schooled in the art and craft of weighing things up against each other, you know, return on investment, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just not working out for him. So which side of that Putin brain prevails?
She thinks
the mystical side.
It's getting dramatically worse.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing we haven't spoken about yet, and I think it would be sort of my indicator in this context of his decision making, is Crimea.
Yeah. Which is, of course, a big one. Yeah.
When he seized it in 2014, there was a big Philip for him in terms of national popularity. All the polls suggested the Russians
even Alexei
him.
Navalny, even the late Navalny, you know, opposition
congratulated
figure.
Him for it.
Absolutely,
yeah, absolutely. So there was a big Russian patriotic cause and a big win for Putin.
So there you go. This is Matt Fry and Mark Urban discussing what, well, of course, most British viewers of Channel 4 News have never been to Russia and don't really know what's going on in Ukraine. So we're trusting these people to tell us what's happening over there. They're making all sorts of claims, such as, that Putin is most concerned about his own prestige.
Well, he's obviously concerned about prestige, but that's hardly an explanation of anything, is it? Really?
Is he going to bring in martial law? That's what they're saying.
What they said, they're not going to bring in martial law. They didn't. Neither of them mentioned there's about to be an election in Russia in September.
Or all of the Ukrainians who've been trying to get, young Ukrainians who are trying to get out of the country desperately that don't want to die.
Yes, well, in actual fact, of course, the European countries are now saying to all the young Ukrainians over here, you've got to go back to fight because we don't want you on benefits over here anymore, do we? We don't want these foreigners here, do we?
Really?
They know.
Why not?
Well,
they're good for the economy. Ooh, migrants.
No, they've got to go back to Ukraine to die.
Yeah.
So that we can have freedom.
Right. Anyway
these kind of guys, they are way, way over, overestimated. They are not experts about this at all.
They're just giving an MI6 line,
This is MI6. This is line.
They've got a briefing from MI6. This is what's going on.
Yeah.
They actually haven't got a clue. They're not even interested. They're just parrot whatever MI6 says. And that's why they've got a job there.
Yes, and it's also obvious to me, why didn't you mention anything about the election coming up? It's, you know,
well, they might do.
Everybody, when we're talking about Trump,
we haven't finished yet. We've got another clip coming up, so
but it's odd that they didn't, because it's obviously the election, and of course the killing of all these young girls in Starobelsk. This is putting fire under the election in Russia. Everybody's demanding that the government does something.
So, do you think the West are escalating attacks on Russia?
They are,
to cause trouble for Putin.
Yeah, what they're doing is they're escalating attacks on the civilian population. The Starobelsk attack was clearly a deliberate attack. It was a three-wave attack. There was no military facilities in the area. What they're doing is they're attacking Russian civilians. They bombed a bus with a boys' football team from Belarus.
Is this the same targeting that the Americans used to kill all the Iranian kids?
Yeah, that's right. So it's the same targeting that the Israelis use. And the idea is if we hit them hard enough, they'll get fed up and then they'll suddenly decide that Putin's to blame for all this and they'll get rid of him.
Do they really believe that? Or do they just think that this pressure is going to cause Putin to start saying, well, look, I just want an end to this.
Well, insofar as the Russians escalate, they can then play that as all the Russians are being
putting personal pressure on him.
Yeah,
really.
But the point is, it's ill-conceived, but they haven't got a lot of other options other than basically giving in and letting the Russians win.
What about
win.
This idea of a mystical Putin?
Well, that's just, isn't it? It's just astonishing. What about mystical Starmer? Mystical Trump? He gets people in to pray all the time. What's Trump's mystical ideas? Have you got any mystical ideas, Mark Urban? You got any mystical? Yes, I like mystical ideas.
No,
it's just rubbish. The decisions aren't all made by Putin anyway. Putin, in fact, is quite a clever politician, and he's well respected. But he can't just do things on his own. He's got all sorts of people he has to square off.
No, I think
not they
happened,
know who they are. Well, Zyuganov, who runs the Communist Party.
There's a lot of unanimity.
They're going to do well.
There's
in
a lot
September.
Of unanimity and trust in the high command of Russia, in both politically and militarily.
Well, what they've done over the years is that obviously there have been wobbles on the road, but they've gradually built it. I think the mood in Russia is what they haven't done is they haven't mobilised the society on a full war footing, because they realise that the people don't want that. They've got plenty of volunteers to fight, so they're not having to conscript people. Conscripts aren't allowed to fight in the Ukraine. Yeah, they do all the train. You know, they do all the guarding inside Russia. The only people in fighting are what they call contract soldiers. Okay, so they've got plenty of people to fight. They know that it's not going to be easy, and then they've just got to keep on going.
So the reason
the
we're
mood
talking
in
about
Russia
this
is one
a couple
of
things.
Determination.
A couple of things have been happening over the last few weeks is drone attacks, which have been focused and concentrating on Russian infrastructure, oil depots, this sort of thing.
Mostly for just dramatic effect. Yeah,
a lot it's of not the, an oil refinery.
No,
it's quite
no.
an important
Come on,
thing.
I've just been reading about this, Tony. A lot of these drones, in fact, have got what are essentially, it's not even an explosive charge. It's just to make a big fire so you can take a picture of it. Oh, gosh, this place
well, that
is
sounds
on fire.
Like Russian propaganda.
Well, it is like Russian propaganda, but that's exactly...
it's no real problem. You know, it's just making a big...
In actual
flare
fact,
in
you can hit oil refineries and they go up in flames, but in actual fact, the damage done is relatively small.
In a way,
small.
The worst thing is that the British are now encouraging them to use these Storm Shadow missiles.
Yes, and also we're providing the drones that killed all those teenage girls and Star Rebels might have been made in Bristol. Yep. That'd be good, wouldn't it?
Well, anyway,
and then the Russians can say, hey, you Bristolians, you killed our teenage girls. Have you got any teenage girls for us?
So let's
or maybe
a,
some of you bigger boys.
Let's have a listen to a bit more of these two experts, Mark Urban and Matt Fry, on Channel 4 News last night.
Now we have this situation where literally in the last few weeks, the Ukrainians have really leveraged some advantages. Now, this includes this business that they've got the Russians shut out of Starlink, the satellite system, which the Russians were using to help guide their drones, but now... the Ukrainians have got the exclusive use of it.
How did they manage to do that, by the way?
They asked. The
and
Ukrainians
Musk said, yes.
asked Musk and the
That shows you how much
the company
their
agreed.
Is,
yep.
That's so interesting.
Well,
the
Russians apparently were kind of spoofing their way on and were using fake Ukrainian credentials and stuff.
Oh, really? Okay.
So, yeah, they reinforced the crypto on the system. But anyway, the fact is that this is thought to be particularly significant in what's called the 50 to 200 kilometer strike range band. Lots of reasons for that. I won't go into all the details. But when you look at what's being done in and around Crimea and the campaign of what the military people would call interdiction, hitting those bridges that connect the railways and the roads in from the top. And of course, you've got the famous bridge that was built by Putin.
The Kerch Bridge.
Now, if you go back.
Which has been rendered unusable anyway.
Well, no, the Kerch Bridge is still just about there, but along with the northern routes in being really hammered over the last couple of weeks, three special ferries have been hit and heavily damaged or destroyed. Now, these ferries are used to load sort of entire trains on or things like that. They can be used for heavy cargoes. They're used a lot by the military to take ammunition across, stuff like that. They've been knocked out. Fuel rationing has been introduced by the governor of Crimea. There are ordinary goods, you know, household goods are running out in the stores. There's a real sense of worry there now in Crimea. Now, to what extent does Putin remain in a bubble where people are afraid to give him the bad news? Or to what extent does he really understand that that cornerstone of his own prestige is now looking wobbly?
But then again, if everything is channeled through sacrifice, the anvil of sacrifice, this is about Mother Russia. This is the great patriotic war all over again. I mean, if that's the case, he's going to have to call it what it is, which is a war, and forget about all this special military operation nonsense. But here's another tiny little indicator that's just occurred to me, which kind of feeds into this argument. So because the Ukrainians have been using drones quite effectively against infrastructure, businesses, oil refineries in Russia proper, most famously during the St. Petersburg Economic Summit, which turned the sky over St. Petersburg black, those refineries are now trying to protect themselves against drones by stringing metal cables across their facilities. Now, it's quite an expensive thing to do, apparently. I'm not in the cable business, but I'm told it is. And it's not particularly effective. But these businesses who are having to do this themselves, because it's not being done by the Russian state, are asking if they can offset the cost of the protection against their taxes. And the answer has been, niet. You cannot do this. That has really upset them.
Yep.
Right. So again, if it was a war, you could probably do it. But because it's a one-off, that's what the authorities are saying, and it's a special operation, you can't.
No, absolutely. But that's where the rhetoric has failed to match the reality. And he is at this, inflection point. And you know, those companies like the oil refiners, they are even now investing in their own methods of defense, active. So, you know, private security guards with heavy machine guns trying to shoot down the drones because, as you say, the Russian state is effectively saying to them, well, you need to up your own protection here and you need to increase your game. So, I mean, there must be tensions there between the people running those industries. And
exactly.
Well, I mean, this is two guys agreeing with each other about what MI6 have told them is happening in Russia.
Starlink, that's true, isn't it? That Musk has switched off the Starlink for the Russians.
So the Russians
it
have
could
adapted.
Be that the Russians can piggyback off of it anyway.
Well, they were piggybacking off it. That's exactly what they were doing. They weren't paying to use it. They were just using it. He's now blocked them from it. But the obvious counter from them, if we are going to go to war, as they're saying, is to knock all the Starlink satellites out. Has Elon Musk got insurance on those satellites? If you're going to be a tech giant involved in warfare and you're going to take a side, all your assets become legitimate targets. Everything
it
that's
does
got
strike
Musk's
me
name
that
on
Musk
it
is
all
actually,
over the planet
Musk
is an absolute target.
Actually, he seems to me far more like some sort of military contractor than he does some
well,
sort
that's
of...
Well, that's right. And if you're going to be a military contractor, your stuff becomes a legitimate
space
target,
space exploration
doesn't it?
Genius. I remember back in the 1960s when we had a... You know, what was his name? Oh, gosh. The TV space programs. You know what I mean? James Burke.
James Burke, yeah.
You got half, I got the other half. And they were week after week after week and month after month with the Apollo missions looking at this. And as I got into my teens, I suppose, what, about a decade afterwards, I'm realizing, well, actually, this is a military, isn't it, really? It was very nice of the Americans to go to the moon and come back again, but this is extremely handy spin-offs when it comes to military research, satellites and all that technology. Everyone wants to dominate space, and of course the Americans now think anyway that they do.
Yes, so that's another reason why the Russians are doing what they're doing, because they're fed up of being pushed around. I mean, the analysis they've made there is weak, very weak indeed.
What's wrong with it?
Let's take it apart. The Kerch Bridge is functioning absolutely normally and has been for years. They've tried to take it down. They've not succeeded. MI6 helped to pay for an attack, which was similar to the provisional IRA. This guy was actually carrying a bomb. He didn't know he was carrying a bomb. His truck blew up. It killed a 14-year-old girl who's going on her holidays with her parents, but it knocked a bigger hole in the bridge. It was all fixed within 24 hours.
I thought they attacked from outside as well,
They've been sending torpedoes and missiles towards it, but it's incredibly
well protected. But you see, it was also well built.
Yes.
This Kerch Bridge was built with the expectation that it was going to be taken out.
Yeah.
And so the sections of it can be, I wouldn't say easily replaced, but quickly replaced.
That's right.
They've got a whole bunch of these, you know, the bridge sections sitting there waiting, right? If there's bridge, well, what we'll do is we'll just take that, you know, if a section is damaged, what we do is we'll just remove it and we'll put another section in. And that's right. So it's got very good foundations too.
That's right. The other thing they were saying is that the passage to Crimea from the north, where you're not coming over the Kerch Bridge in the south, you're coming from the north, so you're coming from Rostov and Don area. Yes, the Iranian, not the Iranians, the Ukrainians, they've got what they're bigging up at the moment is their drones. Yeah, drones which are quite possibly made right here in Bristol. Okay, we've given them £500 million worth of drones, I believe. I was reading that today. Now the Russians are seeing these drones being used to attack oil refineries, university halls of residence where teenage girls are incinerated, and they're thinking, that's not just the Ukraine, is it? That drone was actually made in Bristol, wasn't it? Now, most people in Bristol, unless they're making these drones, will be unaware that those drones came from us.
Yeah, a lot of this is
of
just
course,
about...
This is all about... This
whether the journalists are doing their job,
they're
folks.
Doing their job.
Anyway, here we go, a couple more.
Yes.
Let's have another listen to these two so-called journalists doing their so-called job, which seems to be basically an intern at MI6.
And whenever Russia or the Soviet Union has lost a war, there have been consequences. And the consequences were felt right at the top. Most famously, 1917, the Russian Revolution, you know, or famously, Khrushchev, Nikita Khrushchev, the grandfather of the woman we just interviewed, you know, he lost his job after that as well. So, you know, what will happen to Vladimir Putin down the road? I mean, he seems to be in charge. People are afraid. We have really no idea what's going on inside Russia. Is there an oppositional movement amongst the generals, amongst the extremist nationalist nutters? You know, I don't know. I have no idea. But I can't imagine this will carry on without consequences for him.
No. Well, I guess it's one of those situations where things appear to be extremely gradual and then sudden if bad things are going to happen. But let's go back to Nina's paradigm, which is that he has no choice now because of the budgetary crisis and the other things that are building and the shortage of people, but to declare mobilization, to call it a war, to invoke the spirit of Mother Russia, all of those things. I think that almost has to be accompanied in Putin's terms by a blame of NATO, blaming NATO for the fact that Russia has been put in this situation, and characterizing the explosions going off in Russian cities and all the rest of it as being NATO's work. Right. Now that's dangerous.
That's
dangerous in lots of ways if he chooses to do that.
Because of course it's already been done since the beginning of the war by some of the more outspoken voices on the internet, you know, on Russian television, you know, you hear them all the time. I mean, these are table thumpers who say we're already at war with NATO. They're already fighting us through the back door. And that, apparently that's quite a prevalent vox populi belief on the streets of Moscow and St. Petersburg.
Don't forget, Matt, that there's been a couple of moments where Putin has done his nuclear saber-rattling.
Yes.
One of those was when the whole debate was going on about would America allow Ukraine to use those French and British-supplied Storm Shadow missiles because they relied on some American guidance to get them to their target, American data. And Putin did come out there of the Kremlin and say something along the lines of, well, if NATO uses its weapons to do deep strikes...
We can do the same.
Exactly. We'll draw the appropriate conclusions. Now, this week, a key factory for making microprocessors and circuits for all of those missiles and things that Russia wants to launch at Ukraine in the city of Voronezh, which is 580 kilometers south of Moscow, was hit, we believe, by Storm Shadow missiles. So that is another thing. Yeah. We might always be talking about drones, but this would have been aircraft with pilots in them, Ukrainian ones, launching those British or French supplied missiles at that key plant in Voronezh, which some people are saying bigger impact on the Russian war effort than the amazingly spectacular hits on the refinery in Moscow or Petersburg that turned the sky black. Now, so Putin there has got his
casus belli.
Exactly. If he wants it.
Yeah. Let's be honest. The one thing that has always freaked out governments in, you know, Berlin or Paris to a lesser extent here has been this danger of a real escalation in Europe and perhaps beyond that from a desperate Vladimir Putin with his back up against the wall.
Yeah.
That's always the thing that has prevented the Germans from sending Taurus missiles to the Ukrainians. This is too far. You're baiting the bear. Let's not do that. You know, we'll give them enough to not sink, but we won't give them enough to destroy Russia. Have we got to a point where this has become a self-fulfilling prophecy?
Well,
that's the question that haunts me on a hot day.
Yeah. Let's go back to September of 22, when the Ukrainians had their big military success in the Kharkiv region and swept aside the Russian army. Now, people talk about, the Russians brandished the nuclear option or whatever. Now, here we can get into what the actual military intelligence analysts call indicators. Why did they think that? Why did the Americans and the others think that? Because the nuclear warheads were taken out of the specialist storage sites where they were being kept and issued to the missile units that would have used them. And obviously all sorts of lights started blinking, as it were, on the Pentagon's intelligence dashboard, going, oh my Lord, they're handing the nukes out. Now, was that some kind of signaling at the time? But I think in the subsequent months, the shadow of that moment, as you say, cast it or had its effect on decisions like the German one about, will we send the Taurus missile? Should we send them fighter jets? I mean, go back that far.
Yeah.
Even that was a very active subject of discussion that has now been resolved in Ukraine's favor. But do we come to another moment like that? A lot of people pointing to recent incidents, for example, in the airspace of Baltic countries, where they think the Russians have either been spoofing Ukrainian drones, in other words, messing with their guidance system to get them to stray into Baltic airspace, or deliberately aiming their own ones into provocation.
Well, I mean, they're tiptoeing around what's actually been going on there. The drones they're talking about there have clearly been fired from the Ukraine. I've seen some suggestions that they might have been able to get through with American and British ISR support to get through Petersburg.
What support?
It's called ISR. I can't remember. It's the satellite stuff, yeah? That gives you if you've got satellites, you can that. And they've been using that all along. And of course, there's no secret, and they're not making a secret of the fact that the Ukrainians would have been defeated a long time ago if they hadn't had loads of support from the West, including technical support. I put it to these gentlemen, if the Russians were in fact firing drones and missiles at Britain that were hitting our infrastructure, what would you do? What would you do if you were the Russians, if that's happened? Yeah, they shouldn't have invaded Ukraine. Ukraine shouldn't have had a military coup where NATO actually shot down the pro-EU demonstrators at the beginning of all of this. And they should have massacred the people in Odessa, which then encouraged the people in the eastern oblast to vote to secede and vote for. They had referendums, Tony. We were arguing about a referendum earlier. Referendums. They had a referendum. We don't want to be part of the Ukraine anymore. That wasn't good enough. Crimea has never wanted to be part of the Ukraine. But it's good news that they're having problems now in Crimea, and therefore Putin will fall. And even they are admitting that if Putin falls, the people who are going to take over are the nationalist nutters. And they've also admitted that, in actual fact, on the ground in Russia, that's the general opinion.
Well, they're saying that.
So the general opinion is right. Saying. We don't want your missiles or your drones attacking our teenage girls, and we're getting fed up with it. But of course, that's not anywhere to be found in our media.
What we're saying, which is some people in Russia are saying it's NATO's work.
Well, indeed, this is they've found a roundabout admitting that the population in Russia actually supports the war effort. They're not very keen on it. Who wants a war? But they're actually, because of the history, they're well aware that sometimes you just got to do what you've got to do. Well, once we've had some of our teenage girls killed by a Russian missile strike, then I'm sure everybody would be ready to go and get their heads blown off in the Ukraine. But of course, the Russians, they won't in fact kill our teenage girls. What they will do is they will whack the factory in Filton where they're making these drones,
so the British
and they'll try and minimise the casualties.
A few people in Russia are thinking that this is NATO's work. But clearly, a Storm Shadow missile is NATO's work.
Of course it is.
It's been fired by British, British personnel at a Russian factory which is making drones to defend themselves against this proxy war.
Yes. In other words, especially with Storm Shadows, they're reliant upon technical support, ISR support, you know, with satellites. But in actual fact, the missiles themselves, which is why the Germans didn't want to put the Taurus missile, they have to be fired by British military personnel because the Ukrainians don't know how to use them. Now, those British military people are absolutely fair game. If the Russians can get a missile on them, they're going to not come home in a box, they're not going to come home at all. And, of course, it's absolutely fair from the Russian point of view.
I think I might refrain from putting that full interview up. It's just so awful. Maybe I should do, actually, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. And there is a bit more. But we're going to go over to hear some analysis from Scott Ritter now. He was quizzed earlier this week about his trip to Russia, where he went over from the States to St. Petersburg, and he's very interesting, is that he's actually quite nervous about causing trouble and being booted out of Russia, just as he caused trouble and he had his passport confiscated in the United States.
What European nations are known to be assisting the Ukrainians in attacking inside Russia, Russian assets and Russian people?
Well, we know for a fact that, you know, that England has been called out. The Storm Shadow missiles that were used, at least that's the initial assessment of some people that say they may have been, an early batch of a new American, air launched cruise missile, the AGM-188. There's no evidence that that has actually been delivered. In fact, the first prototypes weren't scheduled to be delivered until October of this year. So they'd have to be way ahead of schedule in order to have reached an operational capability. Most likely it was Storm Shadow that Keir Starmer signed off on. I want to remind people this is back in September of 2024, Keir Starmer was coming to Joe Biden with a red briefcase with the paperwork to get the United States to sign off on using Storm Shadow in such a fashion, and a phone call from Anatoly Antonov, who was then the ambassador, a warning what the consequences would be, prompted the Biden administration to back down. Here we have the British boldly crossing this red line. And as Vladimir Putin has said, they know that this isn't something where the British provide a weapon to Ukraine and then Ukraine acts on it. Russia knows that it was the British who gathered the intelligence. It was the British who enabled the guidance. It was the British that basically did everything but push the button. So Britain is attacking Russia. This is a big problem. But again, the people that say, well, then Putin needs to attack Great Britain, then he does that. And the next question is, and then what? You see, right. Keir Starmer just collapsed. Britain right now is in political chaos. They may not come out of this political chaos. Four prime ministers in 4 years. The next prime minister may not last, you know, 4 months or 4 weeks. Why would Russia want to change this dynamic? The dynamic is in favor of Russia right now. So, yes, the British are attacking. The Germans are attacking. Germans are getting ready to, you know, build new long-range standoff weapons that they will give to Ukraine to carry out the attacks. You know, the British and the Germans are collaborating on the Firepoint 5, the Flamingo. We know the Czechs are involved. We know the Danish are involved. I'm sure if I dug a little bit deeper, I could come up with even more nations that are. The United States is heavily involved. I was hunted down by a drone called the Hornet. The Hornet is built by a company that is funded by Google CEO Eric Schmidt. And I promise Eric Schmidt, if I ever meet you face to face, I'm going to punch you in the face because your Hornet tried to kill me. You tried to kill me. And Judge, you know this. When you commit an act of terrorism, somebody providing meaningful support, like building the drone, to that is culpable in the crime as the terrorist himself. And these drones are being used to target civilians, acts of terrorism. And Eric Schmidt is guilty. The Hornet uses Starlink antennas. That means Elon Musk is guilty of committing acts of terrorism. This is the new reality.
Wow. You recently called, I think I have this right. You know, I followed as much as I could from what you've been writing while you were away. You recently called Europe a rabid dog. What did you mean by that?
Well,
only you could say that.
I had been invited to speak on a panel, a pretty distinguished panel. There was the rector, head of INGIMO, which is the Foreign Policy Institute. It's the the best university in Russia for international affairs. It's where their diplomats are trained. So the head of that university was there. Several of his professors were there, and a deputy foreign minister of the Russian Federation was there. And I was told that this was sort of a chance for me to establish my relation, my reputation as a very calm, rational thinker, because many Russians were intimidated by my passionate moments. And basically the panel was about, you know, the need for diplomacy. Is there a role of diplomacy in the new world? And I was listening to these diplomats, these academics, these, you know, men of peace, basically excuse away everything that Europe was doing. That the day before this panel, St. Petersburg was attacked by drones on the opening day of the forum. There was an ongoing threat of attacks. The Starbell slaughter of 21, innocent, teenagers, was fresh in everybody's mind. And I'm listening to this. And I had prepared a statement, and I was going to call the Europeans nihilists. And I was going to get into a Friedrich Nietzsche laced, discussion of nihilism, part of my effort to be academic. But a British guy on the panel had invoked nihilism first. And I was getting angry, so I said, the hell with it. I'm just going to bring up To Kill a Mockingbird. I said, look, Atticus Finch was an American lawyer. He believed in the rule of law, just like these men do. Believe in the rule of law, and law is important. And we don't have civilized society without the rule of law. But what the hell good does law do you when a rabid dog is running loose in the streets? And in To Kill a Mockingbird, they turned to Atticus Finch to kill the dog, not because of his legal pedigree, but because during World War I, he was the best shot in the unit and killed more Germans than anybody else. And when a rabid dog's running the street, the only solution is to shoot the dog. And I said, Europe is the equivalent of a rabid dog, and eventually it's going to need to be shot. That caused alarm amongst everybody in the audience. And I thought I would be kicked out of Russia, but apparently when they translated it and was sent up to higher levels, I received an invitation to attend the plenary session, and I got a second row seat, which is a very honorable place. So some people were apparently happy with what I was saying.
Yeah, so that's Scott Ritter there. I'll put a link to the longer piece on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Sounds like the Russians rather like what he had to say about Europe being a rabid dog.
Maybe so, but of course, inevitably, there's going to be some people in Russia, for good reason, who are saying we need to not say anything out of order. We need to keep everything we say calm. We've got to stand up for ourselves, and we've got to make the other side understand that we're not to be pushed around. But, you know, we don't like screaming and shouting because it's a bad, you know, it just creates a bad atmosphere. And I think that's a rational response. You know, don't let the Russians are basically the Russian ordinary population have been gradually educated to dislike the West. When I first used to go there in the 1990s, they were absolutely in love with the West. They just wanted to be like us, and everything in Russia
been watching
was rubbish.
Hollywood, haven't they?
That's
really?
Right. That's right. They were totally deluded about it. But of course, now after all of the things that have happened, they're like. They're sadder and wiser, is how I would describe the mentality. And of course, some of them are, you know, quite belligerent, but they're not in charge. And of course, the soccer moms who will decide the election in September, you know, the middle of the road, ordinary families in Russia, they want the government to stand up for their interests, but they don't want it to be seen to be or to be needlessly belligerent, which is perfectly rational of them. Of course it is.
Glenn Deason is someone else who I think is on Judge Knapp. He's also talking about this potential for things to really start taking off with the NATO-Russian war.
The Russians have always been the very convenient other of the Europeans. I mean, if you go back 200 years, you would have had leading British thinkers from John Stuart Mill and others who were essentially warning against the irrationality of the Russophobia. And this has always been a key problem. And the literature on this is quite thick as well. Now, again, I'd like to be careful in how I phrase myself, but I would argue now Europe has become a cesspool of hatred towards Russia. The rationality is definitely left behind. The the argument, if anyone would suggest that, well, perhaps we should be a bit cautious to not trigger a nuclear war, it's, well, the Russians, they started it, they deserve it, or look what they have done. I mean, all rationality is gone. It's just pure hatred now. And again, no rational assessment. Usually, security, you would try to balance off your deterrence with some reassurance. Now it's just not just deterrence, but increasing the tax on Russia and hoping that they wouldn't dare to retaliate because of, you know, NATO. And of course, while this is happening all at the same time as the U.S. Signals that it would like to draw down its forces in Europe, not entirely, but to a larger extent, then, you know, this is a recipe for war. And that's where we're heading very quickly.
Well, I mean, that's, other people are sharing my view that we could very, very quickly end up in a war. Maybe before Burnham becomes Prime Minister, and certainly before another election in this country.
Well, that's Professor Glenn Deason, as I said, talking to Judge Napolitano.
Yes, generally,
very good channel to listen to if you want to find out something other than Channel 4 News or spoon feeding poison to you. MI6 style. But also, Marty, I noticed this week there's been a few problems between Zelensky and the Poles.
Yes, well, I mean, that goes back to World War II, because, of course, Ukraine was never a state. They tried to create a state on the back of the German invasion of the Soviet Union, and the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, whose slogan, Slava Ukraina, glory to Ukraine, is the slogan of modern Ukraine. Boris Johnson has said it, Keir Starmer said it, glory to Ukraine. That was the slogan of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, who killed loads and loads of Jews at Baba Yar, and they killed 100,000 Poles and their families in Volyn, which is in the West Ukraine. And of course, Lvov, which used to be called, which is now called Lviv, it's a Ukrainian majority city, but before the war, it was a majority Polish Jewish city called Lvov, and it was part of the Russian, it was part of the Polish, you know, the Poland before the war, Respublika Polska. So, of course, the Ukrainian nationalists killed 100,000 Poles, including, you know, people from the Polish Home Army and just loads of random people. Because, of course, the Poles and the Ukrainians have got historical hatreds, because the Ukrainian peasants during the Austro-Hungarian Empire, their landlords were all Poles. So they didn't like the Poles. So they thought it was okay to kill them all. And, of course, the Poles know about this. I mean, this is a problem right-wingers have got all over the world, is that in actual fact they hate each other more than they hate the left. And of course, most people in Britain are absolutely unaware of that antagonism.
Well, unless they're watching Al Jazeera.
A cloud hung over this year's Ukraine Recovery Conference in Poland as relations between Warsaw and Kyiv continue to deteriorate. Now, since the beginning of the war, Poland has been one of Ukraine's biggest allies, providing billions of dollars in aid and opening its doors to millions of Ukrainians fleeing the fighting. But a dispute over history is now testing that relationship.
In light of President Volodymyr Zelensky's consent to name one of the units of the armed forces of Ukraine, Heroes of the UPA, and after consultation with the chapter, I have decided to revoke the order of the White Eagle from the President of Ukraine.
Now, the UPA was a nationalist militia, and Poland associates it with the murder of tens of thousands of Poles during World War II. In the order of the White Eagle, that's Poland's highest honor. But the dispute didn't end there. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky sent the award back through this postal company and posted this picture online, turning a diplomatic disagreement into a very public feud. But the stakes are greater than just a simple award. As Ukraine pushes to join the European Union, it can't afford a prolonged dispute with a close ally, especially one that has a deciding vote in its future membership. Audrey McAlpine, Al Jazeera, Kyiv.
Well, I used to live in eastern Poland for 5 years. I used to live in Lubartów near Lublin, which is not far from Rzeszów, where NATO's main support base for Ukraine is. But, of course, these historical antagonisms are still there, and if you know anything about Eastern Europe, there's lots of them. And of course, most people in the West are totally unaware of any of this. How many people in this country knew where Bosnia was before the war in Yugoslavia started? It was some, you know, might as well have been on Mars. And the same, all of these borders in Eastern Europe are actually decided, the borders of the Ukraine were decided by Lenin, Khrushchev and Stalin. Yeah, in that, not in that order. Lenin decided the original borders. Stalin then increased the size of the Ukraine to the west, so he took in what had been parts of Poland and parts of Ukraine and parts of Hungary, including their the Hungarian population is still there in the west Ukraine. They're not very happy about being in the Ukraine at all. The Polish population in what is now the Polish border side of Ukraine, they were all wiped out. But of course,
about towns like Lviv?
Lviv was a Polish town before the war with a very large Jewish minority. But when the Ukrainians took it over, they killed them all. All the Jews and all the Poles, because they wanted it.
Well, this is one of the things that we're supposed to not know about is the far right and Ukraine's military culture. I'll put a link up to this article in Responsible Statecraft at thisweek.org.uk. Over the weekend, many Ukrainian military units using Nazi symbols are led by men shaped by Azov and the far-right milieu around it. For example, there is the Oleksandr Kravtsov, the well-known commander of the Vedmedi unit, which is part of Azov. His body is covered in Nazi imagery, including 1488, references to the white supremacist 14 words slogan coined by David Lane, and the coded salute Heil Hitler, H for the eighth letter of the alphabet, tattooed across his chest, is the SS motto, My Honour is Loyalty. He turned that slogan into the motto of his own unit. SS lightning bolts became part of its official insignia. After returning from Russian captivity, Kravtsov's unit was folded into the Ukrainian military structure. First the 36th Brigade and then the 39th Coastal Defence Brigade. Nothing changed. The SS symbols and the motto remained.
That's right, because, I mean, the Ukrainian army, official army, these paramilitary organisations were separate from it, but they were integrated into it after the coup in 2014, in which the demonstrators were shot down by a NATO death squad, which we could go into. We have done on the pressure previously. And they were allowed to, it's as if the Ulster Defence Association or the Ulster Volunteer Force had been allowed to become part of the British Army and have access to all of its weaponry and so on. And of course, they are, in fact, the elite of the Ukrainian military, and they get better food, they're looked after properly, whereas the ordinary grunts, many of whom are trying to escape from being drafted, because it's a death sentence. I mean, on the actual battlefield, it's a grind, but the Russians are saving the lives of their own guys by basically going very slowly, and what they do before they go anywhere is they've killed everybody in there before they get there, and they're using all of the advantages they've got to massively kill off the Ukrainian military.
Well, we were helping during the Second World War. We were helping out with the Russians. We were sending them some of our tanks over. For example, Bomber Command from Lincolnshire were destroying quite a lot of places like the Ruhr, where the Nazis' war machine was based, their factories and stuff. So why is it now they're the enemy?
Well, because even as you know, through all the research that you've done, Tony, ultimately World War II ended with the defeated Nazis integrated into the Western setup, and the Soviet Union then becomes the enemy.
So not just the Azov and the Ukrainians.
Well, don't forget, there's a massive diaspora of Ukrainian right wingers in places like Canada. There's so many of them that they're able to swing elections, and they've even got statues of their famous heroes who fought on the German side and killed loads of Jews.
Well, going back to this article
in Canada,
Responsible Statecraft, excellent article. They're talking about the Azov Battalion. They said that the Azov has now normalised the Black Sun, the symbol born in Himmler's SS cult headquarters at Wewelsburg Castle, and now used globally by neo-Nazis and white supremacist terrorists, including the 2019 Christchurch mosque terrorist in New Zealand and the recent San Diego Islamic Center shooter. So this is normal over in the Azov. battalion, the Black Sun, it was, as they say here, Himmler's symbol. And of course, we also hear about things like the Dark Enlightenment. There's something resurgent here about Nazi ideology.
Well, there certainly is, and of course the Russians have been pointing this out from the get-go to Gafford. You know, we all know that Putin is Hitler, Tony. Of course, in Russia, that suffered 27 million casualties in World War II, the highest number of anybody, they think all of this stuff about how we're the new Nazis is in very poor taste.
Well, they name one after another, several here, units of the Ukrainian army that use the Black Sun symbol. They're not even ashamed of it. They've got it, patches of it on their clothing and symbols on their tanks and things.
Yeah, well, in Yugoslavia in the 1990s, there were right-wing paramilitaries on the Croatian side who were also from that school. Yeah, the Ustasha, Pavlovich. Yeah, they were, you know, the Croatians and the Ukrainians were the most enthusiastic pro-Nazis in Europe. And of course, the Russian speakers and the Jews and the Serbs were the intended target. Jasenovac was a Croatian-run concentration camp.
I mean, this is
in
this
what is now Croatia. And, you know, hundreds of thousands of Serbs, Gypsies, Jews, communists were all murdered in there. In horrible ways, because they didn't do like the Germans used to go into things like, you know, gas chambers, which is sort of kind of almost a, you know, what's the word? It's kind of very hygienic kind of killing. Mm. The Croatians used to go in for good old fashioned chopping people to bits with machetes and electrocuting them.
Well, it's not so efficient, is it?
No, it's not. It's more efficient, but it's more fun.
Right. So anyway,
the
drone units were with the Ukrainian army. I mean, this is, to me, this is one of the key aspects that the mass media is just completely hiding from the British public, from the Western public. Some units within Ukraine's military don't hide their fascination with the Third Reich's military culture. For example, the 422nd Regiment of Unmanned Systems, this is a drone unit, calls itself Luftwaffe, uses virtually the same eagle as Hitler's Air Force. So this is Hitler's Air Force, and they're quite... Of course, the Russians are saying, well, you know, you're behaving like Nazis, and you're even taking all this Nazi symbolism on. Of course, they're very tempted to get rid of these people. And we are supporting them. We are funding this.
That's right.
This is our taxpayers' money.
Loads of Germans are funding this as well. Yeah. That's what Chancellor Merz wants to do.
And these units, I'm sure our Nazi listeners will be glad to hear, do merchandising as well of these Nazi symbols.
Well, yes. So, in other words, it's all out there in the open for anybody who's got access to a mobile phone. Just ask the question, you'll get the answers.
Isn't it interesting the way that this has all changed? I suppose since the last people who can actually remember the Second World War pretty much have passed away.
Well, I mean, they're
certainly not in positions of power anyway.
Well, no, I mean, historians always say, I mean, obviously it's a bit of a truism that people forget about wars and then that's why they have them again, because they've forgotten all about it and they've forgotten why they did it in the first place. It's all become, I mean, what gets me about the British public in general is not that they are bad, it's that they allow themselves to be deluded that they live in a bubble and all this stuff is happening somewhere else and we can get involved in it and we can wave a little flag and say we're on Ukraine's side and all the rest of it, but there's no real consequences. Have you noticed how the Ukrainian flags have kind of disappeared now? Because obviously things have moved on and it's not really flavour of the month anymore, but afraid the war still drags on. Millions are already dead.
And also,
millions are dead here in this war. Hundreds of thousands, millions.
We had our little chit-chat last week about dialogue and Peter Thiel, his little cult that he's setting up, and not quite, I think it's actually Ali McForever again that had a good old look at that as well. She didn't miss it.
Peter Thiel hosting secret event in Wicklow Hotel. Leak exposes members of Peter Thiel's secretive dialogue society. Dialogue is a 20-year-old invitation-only society founded by Peter Thiel. No public website, no disclosed members until today. There is a story breaking at the moment about the Dialogue Society. Dialogue is a secret war council of billionaires, army generals, intelligence chiefs, the exact people who hollowed out your government from the inside and now run it from a luxury hotel, off the books, behind closed doors with zero accountability. Before I get into this, I want to correct the framing, and this is no shade to the Ditch, who I adore. I just want to correct is this Peter Thiel emphasis. Dialogue was founded in 2006 by Peter Thiel and Aaron Hoffman. Everybody knows who Thiel is. Most people have never heard of Hoffman. But Hoffman's career is a masterclass in building the plumbing of mass surveillance. He is the one who builds the data infrastructure that is creating the world that him and Thiel want possible. He founded LiveRamp in 2011, which is an identity resolution service. This is the technology that connects your offline data, your name, address, and purchase history, to your online cookies, your actual activity. This is making it possible for governments and corporations to track individuals across every aspect of their lives. He sold this company to Axicom Holdings, who are the largest data brokers in the world, with files on over 700 million consumers globally. LiveRamp is the connective tissue that makes modern surveillance capitalism function. After selling LiveRamp, Hoffman founded SafeGraph in 2016. The pitch for this company was selling access to data on physical spaces, so geolocation data from mobile apps, tracking foot traffic to millions of businesses and homes. SafeGraph sells your data to hedge funds, real estate investors, and crucially, government agencies. During the COVID pandemic, the CDC used SafeGraph data to track population movements and compliance with lockdowns. COVID was very handily a nice testing environment for SafeGraph. We talk a lot about Peter Thiel, but Hoffman built the actual operating systems of mass surveillance. This secret society that is meeting in Wicklow in August was founded by both of them. The details of this event got leaked because Dialogue's membership was stored in source code. That kind of oversight, leaving a member directory in a JavaScript file, betrays the logic of Hoffman's entire career. It proves that these systems that they're building absolutely can and will and do get hacked on the regular. And nobody likes it when their personal information and their location gets dumped into the open web. The other thing I want to talk about is how this is being reported on, by who. What's the chain of events here? And what is Wired up to? The story starts here on Blue Sky at 1:19 in the morning on the 16th of June. Swiss hacker and legend Maya Arson Crimu wrote on Blue Sky, "Here are all 113 alleged members we were able to successfully extract. This data can also be verified via versions of the site captured by the Wayback Machine, even if it doesn't properly render the site. I do not know whether this is like society members or speakers slash guests at society meetings or whatnot, but I also don't know how much of such a distinction even exists. It is very hard to find out anything tangible about how this organization works. Also, if you want to support Maya Arson Crimu, you can do so at ko-fi.com/Nyan Crimu. Oh, and also for journos, I'm reachable on signal@nyancrimu.01. That's your primary source. Hackers got at the source code and posted on Blue Sky at 1 o'clock in the morning. This Wired article shows up at 4 p.m. the next day. Before I tell you what changed between that original source material and what Wired is presenting, I want to tell you about Wired's ownership. So Wired is owned by Condé Nast, the American mass media company founded in 1909 and headquartered at One World Trade Center in the financial district of Lower Manhattan. Condé Nast is in turn owned by Advance Publications. This is another privately held American media company owned by the families of Donald Newhouse and Samuel Irving Newhouse Jr. These are the sons of the man who set up Condé Nast. Advance Publications owns Condé Nast, American City Business Journals, and then 30% of Reddit and 5% of Warner Brothers Discovery. This article by Wired is the opposite of independent journalism. This magazine is owned by a private family media conglomerate. It has revenue partnerships with OpenAI. It draws its operating capital straight from Silicon Valley. The fact that the owners of Wired also own 5% of Warner Brothers Discovery is a weird coincidence, because do you know who else is financially entangled with Warner Brothers Discovery? John Malone, the owner of Powers Court Hotel in Wicklow. The owner of the hotel that is hosting these supervillains was the chair of Warner Brothers Discovery until April 2025. He still retains a strategic advisory role. I think it's important that we correct the misconception that Wired broke this story. Blue Sky broke this story at 1 o'clock in the morning, and by the next afternoon, Wired was scrambling to control the narrative. Just quickly on Malone also, the hotel was purchased in March 2019 for €50 million by Wicklow Hotel Partnership, which is wholly owned and controlled by John Malone and Leslie Malone. It is incorporated in Colorado as Irish Holdings, the second LLC, and the hotel is operated under Malone's MHL Hotels Collection alongside Paul Higgins and John Lally. As the chairman at Warner Brothers Discovery, Malone was instrumental in the 2022 merger of Warner Brothers and Discovery. He held talks with Rupert Murdoch in 2024 about a potential WBD-Fox merger, Warner Brothers Discovery and Fox. So the billionaire who owns the hotel where this meeting is happening and the parent company of the publication that you think broke this story are shareholders in the same media corporation. Crimeo published 113 alleged member names. Those 113 names came directly from the source code of the Dialogue website. Wired published 222 names. All Wired says about where it got those extra names is a source separately provided to Wired. No description of who that source is or how they obtained this extra list. No description of what, if any, verification steps that Wired took beyond just stating independently verified and then pointing back to the original directory, which still only references 113 names, not 222.
Yeah, well, I think she's nitpicking there. It's nice that she's picked up on this story. But quite clearly, a media company can report good things on people who are connected with it. The fact that it's got a 5% stake in a really big media company is neither here nor there. These families can operate independently, potentially. But I think, for example, you're saying, well, they haven't said where they've got this information from. Fine. Because if they've got their information from a source that needs protecting, they don't have to say where they've got it from. The fact is, they've got the information. They're trusted enough to this, they have trusted these names of this Dialogue group enough to stake their reputation on it. Fine, let's see if it's true. It may not be. But anyway, for me, the last week or so, it's been a bit of a weird world to think that that this exists. She seems to be sort of poo-pooing it, saying, you think these people broke the story? Well, they did, on a mass media scale. And Wired is a very well-read and well-accepted. And a lot of people, say, for example, Forbes, have done a whole big piece on it. But many of the mainstream media outlets in the West have just totally ignored it, Martin.
Well, I mean, this is like going to a kind of convention of model railway enthusiasts. You know, certain people are interested in the deep state, and we're one of them.
Tech giants and NATO having a little secret get together in Wicklow.
Well, I mean, that is interesting, isn't it? But of course, the mainstream media—most mainstream journalists—you say, well, what is Bilderberg?
No, they go, what? They have no interest in the Bilderberg, apparently, even though actually it's a secret parallel government.
If you're a mainstream journalist with kids in private school and a mortgage to pay, I mean, you really don't want to be asking silly questions about things like that, do you? It's obvious
from the failure of the democratic process and the political system that we're witnessing. We should be looking about where the power really lies, and this is one of those places, clearly, where it does.
Well, that's right, but of course most people have got far too much to think about, either positive or negative, to worry about these things. You know, no doubt people who are listening to this show are interested in this sort of stuff, but that's a minority, folks, I'm afraid.
Anyway, finally, we had Benjamin Friedman last week talking about the First World War. Very interesting talk from the 1960s at a big hotel in Washington, D.C., I can't remember the name of the hotel. I'm sure some listeners remember right away what it is. But a bit more from his talk this week, finally. And this is about the Zionists and the Jewish origins in Khazaria. Apparently, many of the European Jews actually aren't from the Middle East at all. Never mind they've got a right to go back. These ones are not from the Middle East.
The Jews, I call them Jews to you because they're known as Jews. I don't call them Jews. I refer to them as so-called Jews because I know what they are. If Jesus was a Jew, there isn't a Jew in the world today. And if those people are Jews, certainly our Lord and Savior was not one of them. And I can prove that. Now what happened? The Eastern European Jews, who form 92% of the world's population, of those people who call themselves Jews, were originally Khazars. They were a warlike tribe that lived deep in the heart of Asia. And they were so warlike that even the Asiatics drove them out of Asia into Eastern Europe. And to reduce this, so you don't get too confused about the history of Eastern Europe, they set up this big Khazar kingdom, 800,000 square miles. Only there was no Russia, there were no other countries, and the Khazar kingdom was the biggest country in all Europe. So big and so powerful that when the other monarchs wanted to go to war, the Khazars would loan them 40,000 soldiers. That's how big and powerful they were. Now, they were phallic worshippers, which is filthy. I don't want to go into the details of that now. It was their religion, the way it was the religion of many other pagans or barbarians elsewhere in the world. Now, the king became so disgusted with the degeneracy of his kingdom that he decided to adopt a so-called monotheistic faith, either Christianity, Islam, the Muslim faith, or what is known today as Judaism. Really Talmudism. So, like spinning a top, he said, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, and he picked out so-called Judaism. And that became the state religion, and he sent down to the Talmudic schools of Palombifa and Sura, and brought up thousands of these rabbis with their teachings. And he opened up synagogues and schools in his kingdom of 800,000 people, 800,000 square miles, and maybe 10 to 20 million people. And they became what we call Jews. There wasn't one of them that ever had an ancestor that ever put a toe in the Holy Land, not alone in Old Testament history, but back to time, the beginning of time. Not one of them. And yet they come to the Christians and they asked us to support their armed insurrection in Palestine by saying, well, you want to certainly help repatriate God's chosen people to their promised land, their ancestral homeland. It's your Christian duty. We gave you one of our boys as your Lord and Savior. You now go to church on Sunday and kneel, and you worship a Jew, and we are Jews. Well, they were pagan Khazars who were converted just the same as the Irish. And it's just as ridiculous to call them people of the Holy Land as it would be. There are 54 million Chinese Muslims. 54 million. And Muhammad only died in 620 A.D. So in that time, 54 million Chinese have accepted Islam as their religious belief. Now imagine in China, 2,000 miles away from Arabia, where the city of Mecca is located, where Muhammad was born. Imagine if the 54 million Chinese called themselves Arabs. Imagine. Why, you'd say they're lunatics. Any man that believes that those 54 million Chinese are Arabs must be crazy. All they did was adopt as a religious faith a belief that had its origin in Mecca, in Arabia. The same as the Irish. When the Irish became Christians,
Nobody dumps them in the ocean and imported from the Holy Land a new crop of inhabitants that were Christians, that had Christian flesh and blood. They weren't different people. They were the same people, but they had accepted Christianity as their religious faith. Now these pagans, these Asiatics, these Turco-Finns, they were a mongoloid race who were forced out of Asia into Eastern Europe. They likewise, because their king took the faith, this Talmudic faith, they had no choice, just the same as in Spain. If the king was Catholic, everybody had to be a Catholic. If not, you had to get out of Spain. So everybody, they lived on the land, just like the trees and the bushes. A human being belonged to the land under that feudal system. So they all became what we call today Jews. Now imagine how silly it was for the Christians, for the great Christian countries of the world to say, we're going to use our power, our prestige, to help repatriate God's chosen people to their ancestral homeland, their promised land. Now, could there be a bigger lie than that? Could there be a bigger lie than that? And because they control the newspapers, the magazines, the radio, the television, the book publishing business, they have the ministers in the pulpits, they have the politicians on the soapboxes talking the same language. So naturally, you'd believe black is white if you heard it often enough.
So, yes, from a couple of weeks ago, we introduced that amazing talk that is by Benjamin Friedman. He's also there, Martin, talking about something which many people mention, which is that actually this is a whole Israeli right to return to the Holy Land is a fraud.
Well, I mean, it was Arthur Koestler, who was, and I presume Benjamin Friedman is Jewish, and Arthur Koestler was also Jewish. He wrote The 13th Tribe, which started to popularize the idea that many East European Jews, Ashkenazi Jews, were not in fact originally from the Holy Land, or what we call, or Israel. They were the Khazarian ruling elite. This is in what is now Ukraine, actually, sort of in the north, you know, the areas north of Crimea. They basically, what was happening at this stage of the game is non tribes which had actually got, you know, their own traditional beliefs, you know, the standard steppe beliefs in Tengri, the sky god, and stuff like that. But once you become a power, you have to have some kind of religious core to it. And of course, in Britain, in England, they decided that they were going to adopt Roman Catholic Christianity as the core belief of the state. And it was very much, you know, if you look at the conversion of the English, it was very much the ruling class deciding we're going to become Christians, and then gradually it filtered down to the lower orders, as it were. And the same thing happened in Khazaria. There's much dispute about that. They decided, because they've got the Russians to the north, they've decided that they're going to become Orthodox, and they've got to the south, they've got Muslims, so they decided they don't want to be either of those things, so we'll choose the third option, being Jews, because that gives us a unique identity. So our enemies to the north are Christians, our enemies to the south are Muslims, but we Khazars, we are Jews.
Okay,
they converted.
Ashkenazi Jews.
Can I just finish? Yeah. That's just the basic story. Now, then the story is, or it's suggested by Arthur Koestler and others, that in actual fact, the population, the big Jewish population in Eastern Europe, and particularly in Russia, were actually descended from the Khazars. Now, there's lots of Zionist counter scholasticism about this, and they're saying no, all the evidence shows that the Jews came from the Mediterranean into the Eastern European countries, and a place like Poland had a very big Jewish population because in the Middle Ages it was the most tolerant of Jews. Yeah, the Polish monarchy was quite happy to have Jews under its rule.
Apparently, so Germany was actually, apparently.
Yes, that's right. And of course, Russia was more problematic because the Khazarian Jews had been the enemies of Russia traditionally. Yeah, so there was
many of these Jews apparently went out to the Americas in the 1800s too.
Well, of course, if
I think that the fact is that, you know, it's not still not clear. Although there was a BBC Two documentary about all of this by Steve, can't remember his name, he's a geneticist, and it was part of a series about genetics, and he was making all of these points, because of course we can actually check now, yeah, where people came from. You do a basic check and you can show where they came from and who they're related to. But of course the Israeli lobby lobbied hard on BBC not to show that programme. So it was never shown.
That's it. Probably was disappeared, shown. I think.
It's disappeared into the archive. Now, I would say, to my point of view, it doesn't really matter whether they originally came from there or not, because in actual fact, in 1948 and in 1917, the majority of people in that area were not Jews. There were some Jews there. They'd been always living there. They were part of the community. But you can't just bring in a load of other people from outside and say, we're taking over around it. The locals are bound to resist. Especially if you're going to take the land off
them. Just to sort of complete the picture, we've got those Ashkenazi Jews you're talking about. There's also the Sephardic Jews, which are from the Iberian Peninsula, Spain and Portugal. Apparently.
That's right. And they obviously unlikely to be Khazarian. So in other words, there's all sorts of possible. And of course, you've got Ethiopian Jews. They're definitely Jews. There's no doubt about it. Some of the studies that were done in the genetics program that I watched by Steve, I can't remember his second name, but he's famous. And there's a tribe in Botswana, I think it is, that always claimed that they were Jews. And they're part of the Zulu Federation. And they look like Zulus. The big, tall guys, black guys. But they've got some customs which are, you know, Jewish. They circumcise their young men and all the rest of it. They circumcise their children.
So the Middle East and North African Jews are called Mizrahi Jews.
Yes, okay. So in any way, even in Botswana, I think it was, or another South African country, they did a test. It is clear that they do, in fact, have Jewish ancestry, because Jewish traders penetrated into Africa quite early. And of course, when you're a trader like Marco Polo, you're not taking your wife and kids with you. So what eventually happens is you settle down and marry local girls, and then your custom. So the customs, and when the British conquered the Southern African region, this particular tribe, whose name I've forgotten, they claimed to be Jews, and they thought they can't possibly be Jews. They don't look like Jews. What's this all about? Turns out they were. But of course, what may be the case is plenty of people in Israel who claim to be Jews. Genetically, they're not.
So why does this matter, or doesn't it?
It doesn't really matter. It's useful to pick through it, but the real issue here is not your genetics. You can't just walk into somebody else's country and say it belongs to you. Doesn't matter what the Bible says. It says, if the people are living there now, we've fought two world wars against the idea that you can just take over other people's countries. That's what it was all about. And you can't just dump these people on the Palestinians. There's Palestinians who are definitely directly descended from the original Jews. Of course they are. They're the Fellahin who have worked that land for many, many years. They converted first to Christianity under the Roman Empire, then later to Islam. But they, in fact, are the original Jews. There's no doubt about that.
Thank you, Martin, for helping clear that up. And I'll put another version of that long talk by Benjamin Friedman from the 1960s up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And oh, this week, you've got to pick a pocket or two. The ultra wealthy never lose. Exemptions, loopholes, while they schmooze. High-rise hikes on people's homes now drags them into bare-bone zones. Pickings slim, but still must pay. Inheritance are tax, they say. A fight with farmers, what a spat. A 2.5 million cap. IHT now drags them in, 20%, a no-win-win. Fagan's crew for BlackRock schemes now squeeze our lives, our hopes, our dreams. Where'er we look, a tax demanded, a dance on death, vile, underhanded. While Charlie lives at large in homes, his mansions out of danger zones. Grieving sons and grieving daughters, a tax on death should never oughta be made to sell to pay these grabbers, human vultures, deathbed nabbers. Thank you very much, Patricia. Fagin taught his boys, you've got to pick a pocket or two just to survive. Today, the government acts as Dickens' ultimate powerful pickpocket through inheritance tax, waiting till you die to stick its hand into your family's estate. Where once upon a time this was big mansions, now it's most of the family homes in London. They're getting caught out. Anyway, that's all for this week. Sorry, we haven't had time for the stuff on Dr. Beach, and we'll do that next week with reviving an interview I did a long time ago with Richard Cottrell, who's the author of Doctor Who, Bomber Beaching and His War on the Railways, which is just only finally getting into print for the very first time since the 50th anniversary of the Beaching Cuts in 2013. It was also, we'll be having a bit more. I think this is going to definitely become a running theme on this program, is the royal finances. We've already done quite a lot over the years, but we've still got several bits and pieces to do from the David Dimbleby series. It's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off. Thanks for Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And also to sound engineer Dave Bozanko. You can download this show as an MP3 from 11 p.m. to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. You can share story tips. Best place to do that is on that Telegram group, as I said. I am shadow banned on X at Tony Gosling, although I'm back again. I've been resurrected magically by some AI bot on X for the crime of tweeting something that could potentially go viral about the timing of the announcement of Starmer 3.5 hours after the Americans had said he's going to resign. My paperbacks, firstly about deals between Churchill and the Nazis at the end of World War II, The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group. That costs £15. You can get it via www.bilderberg.org. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the stream, except 5 p.m. Monday to Thursday, when you can hear the Richie Allen Show live. We're streaming live still just about from Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream at djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, on holylandradio.com from 11 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Central Time at 87.7 FM in West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the glorious Bristol Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast this show, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the Bristol Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the synagogue of satanic banksters, from the Book of Revelation, by the way, get you down.
Today, but had to go to visit you. You never know.